Here we go again.
It's time to talk.
I thought it was April Fool's Day when I heard that one. Get me off the air before I have a heart attack. We will have nothing to see for it. There's been many false dawns.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
The kindness of Cork people will never let you down.
Conversation that matters.
Be part of the conversation. The Neil Prendeville Show with Mercedes-Benz Cork. Well, you know, when we get a bit of good weather, as usual, the papers love to pick up on it. Sunny skies are clear to stay. Temperatures won't hit the highs of last weekend. I was interested in that story because I read into it then. They were saying the weekend just gone, they got a high above in Newport Furness in Mayo on Sunday of 20 degrees. And over in Claremorris, just slightly under 20 degrees. But yesterday, for sure, the entire country basked in the warm sunshine, and Met Aran are saying that the dry spell will continue for days. Now, yeah, days, but if nothing changes, wet on Saturday. But anyway, it's always nice to be talking about the weather because everyone is in better form, aren't they? Everyone's much more optimistic, and maybe that's what it likes to be. That must be what it's like to be Mediterranean, don't you think? Anyway, very sad news, and this has been dominating the papers for a number of days, and it is the death of Aoife Johnson. Front pager, again, making the red tops today. We begged for help as we watched Aoife die. They're referencing the A&E-like war zone that was Limerick University Hospital, or University Hospital Limerick, when Aoife Johnston was in there and died. She was screaming in agony. Her parents were repeatedly begging for help before the 16-year-old died from sepsis, having spent 12 hours on a chair at the hospital. And this is, of course, her inquest that's been going on now for a number of days. She lay dying on a chair for 12 hours. What more will it have to take for things to be sorted and fixed and for somebody somewhere to just get a handle on our crisis in health that has gone on for decades and decades? And listen to me, you will find there'll be more election promises than ever again now that all sorts of different stuff will be fixed. And Simon Harris isn't found wanting in the papers this morning with the promises. More about that in a second. But it's a front pager making both Mail today, the death of Aoife, and the Star. How much more do we have to put up with? Our children are dying in hospital when they could be saved. The trial of the... That's a story, actually, from March of 2022. And this is the trial following the death of a man back in March of 2022, where a Cork man's been accused of murdering his brother. Now, Liam Healan's court report makes the Examiner this morning, and just a few paragraphs on this because it's an ongoing trial. The trial of a Cork man accused of murdering his brother heard that the victim dragged the accused off his father before being stabbed himself. Now, just to explain that, put it into context, John Murphy is 43. He's also accused of the attempted murder of his father, Weishi Murphy, in March of 2022. And the allegation is that in the early hours of the morning, Weishi, the dad, was in bed watching golf on television. At 10 to 3 in the morning, the accused, John Murphy, came into Weishi's bedroom, and for no reason, he made a request for his father to go into the neighbour's house. So Weishi started to get dressed, but John pushed him, it's alleged, onto the bed and began strangling him. Now, Weishi pleaded with his son to stop, and he called for his other son, Shane, to help. Shane then pulled John off his father, and this allowed John, who's before the court, John Murphy, to, as it says in the papers this morning, this allowed John to get out. But then Shane started screaming that he'd been stabbed and to get an ambulance. And it was put to the detective giving that evidence in court yesterday that Shane was acting to protect his father, and the detective replied, yes, selfless, actually, yes. And so that trial into the death of Shane is before the Cork courts this morning. There's quite a lot of coverage of it, and it will continue for some time to come. Do you remember the other story of the fellow who was taking out passports in dead babies' names? He's got jail for himself now. And this is a Cork story as well. Although I'm reading the Olivia Kelleher copy in the Star this morning. He's an American, right? And he applied for passports in the names of two dead babies. He said he was running into visa difficulties while he was in Europe. Anyway, he's got 3.5 years jail, and in typical Irish fashion, with the last 15 months suspended. So half the sentence, I suppose. His real name is Randolph Kirk Parker. He's 73. He was at Cork Circuit Criminal Court. The evidence was heard again yesterday. He made an application to renew an Irish passport in the name of Geoffrey Warbrook. I say that in inverted commas. Whereas Geoffrey Warbrook was actually the name of a child who died in the early 1950s in Ireland when he was an infant. He also at one stage appeared in person to renew a passport in the name of Philip Frank Morris. And Philip Morris was an Irish-born infant who died in 1952. So they put a stop to his gallop for a little while anyway. Papers this morning have some good news. Households are set for new cuts of up to 20% on your energy bills, your electricity and your gas. Like the wholesale cost, it's a story in the front of the Inter today, the wholesale cost of electricity is now 78% lower now since the peak at the height of the crisis in the autumn of 2022. So bills have been dropping, you know, slowly but surely, and one drops and the others follow. We still have a long way to go, but there's another one on the way, which is great. I mean, it really should be 78% drop if you think of it, because, you know, the host, they call it the cost per megawatt hour. But anyway, it's good news nonetheless. And then I mentioned at the top of the hour there with regards to Simon Harris, who Eamon Dunphy at the weekend called a spoofer. A spoofer? Spoofer is kind of a Dublin word, isn't it? What's a spoofer? Is it like a bluffer? A bluffer, I would think, maybe? A plumosser? Anyway, Simon Harris will today make an official state apology to the families of the 48 Stardust victims, the teenagers and young people who never came home. They were unlawfully killed. But he also makes the news for other reasons. He says he intends to pass the hate speech bill before the next general election. Now, whether they'll tweak it or dicky around with it or just leave it as it is, I have no idea. But there's a lot of division in Ireland over this hate speech legislation in the sense that, many people feel that it's a muzzle of the public and it's a step too far. But he's also making promises. And I don't know how many of them are empty promises. He'll fix housing. He'll fix health. He'll do everything that needs to be done. And also, he's drawing up a plan to get rid of the dreaded universal social charge, and that's putting it mildly, calling it dreaded. It's an horrific extra tax. It's a sneaky one they brought in years ago. It was originally called the temporary universal social charge, but of course very soon after that they dropped the word temporary, and it's just a given now that you pay PRSI, you pay PAYE, you've also stuff like that, and you also pay the universal social charge. They even made a pledge back in 2016, Fine Gael, that they would abolish it. But it was a part of their election manifesto, the false promises that are made. But soon after the election, of course, they dropped it. And what did they say when they dropped it? Well, you know something? It would be just too expensive to implement. False and empty election promises. Meanwhile, in the real world, of course, we have 61 fewer Gardaí than we had 2 years ago on Leaside, or an English historian, the Examiner this morning, and we have 24 fewer Garda stations than 10 years ago. The crisis in all sorts of things that matter continues, and issues on our road are never far. I gave you some driving statistics, like the character who was caught doing 194 in Castle Martyr in a 100-kilometre zone. There's another one that makes the Examiner this morning as well, where a teacher, a maths teacher, not that it matters what she's teaching, she had two children, two infants in the back of the car, a teacher caught speeding doing 102 kilometres an hour in a 50-kilometre zone with two infants in the car, said to the guards when she stopped, "You were very harsh for stopping me," when she was caught by a Garda speed check. Now, she was in a blue Skoda Octavia at more than twice the speed limit in Kilbenny in County Limerick in 2022. She makes the papers this morning, Catherine Boyle, because she was convicted of careless driving, fined €500 and given 2 months to pay. You know, they call it careless driving. Do they ever decide to convict somebody for speeding? Is it always called careless driving? Anyway, her solicitor said there's a lot of remorse now, and she realises that there was a lot of remorse and lots of recognition on her part that you shouldn't be driving at 102 kilometres an hour and a 50. I don't know whether she will learn from her lesson. Do people do? Perhaps they do. I see Cynthia Nivoruku is making the papers today. I'll talk to her in a few minutes' time regarding a thing called, it's like a system that's put into cars. They're called interlocks. rockers. They're very popular in Europe and they're very popular in Scandinavia, where before your car will start, you have to blow into some sort of a breathalyzer mechanism that's fitted to the car to detect if you're over the blood alcohol level. Would that work? Text 0868 104 106 on that one. And also the papers this morning, it was a lead story in The Sun today where the filmmaker Jim Sheridan says, in spite of the fact that Ian Bailey has now died and the unsolved murder of Sophie Toscan de Plantier is still a live guard investigation, he's convinced that Ian Bailey did not murder Sophie Toscan de Plantier, and he says that he's going to show the world that in his upcoming movie. So that's a front and inside pager making The Sun today. And then I see other issues with regards to migration, immigration, and those that are coming into various parts of Europe, whether it's as asylum seekers or refugees or under international protection applications. But you know, Rwanda, country in Africa, the English and the British are going to send anybody who has come to England illegally and needs to be deported to Rwanda. And they're ready for them in Rwanda, apparently. They've got everything ready for them, built all of the buildings and the holding places, and they're supposed to be spick and span. And they can take, like, I don't know, they've got 2,000, maybe 3,000 detention spaces ready already. They've chartered the planes, and the planes will begin to fly in the next couple of months. That's a front pager making the UK Times. And then other forms of transport make the papers also. It seems that there is still a demand for electric cars, but a lot of them are fleet cars as opposed to members of the public buying their own electric cars. That has slowed down. It's a story from the UK Times today saying because of the slowdown, 8 in 10 new electric cars being sold at the moment, and this is from Auto Trader, are being sold at a discount because of a drop in public demand for the vehicles. Now, it's also been impacted by the arrival of a lot of the cheaper Chinese electric vehicles. That really has shook up the market and is also bringing prices down. But it's demand and a shake-up in the market. They're saying that now, if you're ever thinking of buying it, well, in the UK anyway, this would be a good time because they're all being sold at discount prices. And they're also suggesting in the papers today, and this is the English Times, that hospital patients are less likely to die if a female doctor treats them. Don't know how male doctors would feel about statistics like this. And it's even better if you are a female patient being seen by a female physician. So it's just very interesting statistics and research. It says that it could be due to the fact that male doctors underestimate the severity of their female patients' illnesses, and that they also underestimate pain levels, cardiovascular systems, stroke risk, things like that, in patients and particularly in female patients. And there's nearly 1 million patients were studied for this now, showing that female physicians are better at saving lives than male, particularly if it's a female doctor treating any patient, but particularly a female doctor treating a female patient. They do say that women have a much higher threshold of pain. They do say that women tolerate a lot more. I don't know whether that's a genealogical thing or within their DNA or their makeup or whatever. What I'm saying, I suppose, is that it's been said in the past that women complain less about sickness and pain and things like that. But more and more you're finding that people are just complaining less anyway. Why do I say that? Final bit of research for you. Mature adults now think that being elderly refers to those not over 65, but actually the age now is 74. So people of a more mature age now are saying that old age does not begin until 74. And at that stage, then you could be really called elderly. It depends, really, I suppose, on the shape you're in, doesn't it? Age is but a number. And speaking of numbers, great news this morning, of course, because Hozier has been come the first Irish artist to have a song reach number one in the US Billboard charts in more than 30 years. It's like 30 years since anybody from Ireland, whether it was a U2 or anybody like that, was number one on the Billboard charts. So Hozier has done it with the song Too Sweet, climbed to the top spot on the Hot 100 yesterday. But there were others, right? In fact, here's a rundown of the Billboard Top 100 number one Irish acts. See if you can pick them out for yourself, right? Never mind me. Have a leisht. When she passed away, I can't live without you. it goes. Hozier's new song, Too Sweet, number one in the US Billboard chart. That is some undertaking. It's hard to crack America. So we had Sinead O'Connor do it once. We had U2 do it twice. We had Gilbert O'Sullivan do it once with Alone Again, Naturally, in 1972. But Claire here, part of this team, also says that Gilbert O'Sullivan went to number two in the Billboard charts years and years ago. With what song? Claire. The moment I met you, I swear. Back after the break.
Call Neil now. 0818-104-106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Be part of the conversation. Text 0868-104-106. So as I was mentioning the papers there on the top of the hour, reading in the mail this morning, the Fianna Fáil European election candidate Cynthia Ní Bhfiriciú has backed an EU proposal to introduce in-car breathalyzers, they're called interlockers, into vehicles for repeat drink and drug drivers. Now, statistically, and I know I dealt with this on the show last week and gave you an awful lot of stats. I don't want to bombard you with statistics, but drink driving in Ireland has remained stubbornly high. Our road deaths are off the charts, and this year it's going to eclipse last year's figures. And I gave stats there recently if you compared us with regard. And I think it's fair to say that a lot of deaths and crashes on our roads, and statistically has been found that people, like of the fatalities where alcohol was detected, a typical example of this, the dead were typically male and under the age of 45, generally occurred in the late evenings or the early hours in the morning, and particularly at weekends. Now, alcohol has been found, cannabis has been found, we're finding more cocaine now, like 7,500 people arrested or detained in 2023 on suspicion of having something in their system and turned out to be drugs. So alcohol and drugs, and 87% of the drivers killed on the roads while driving above an appropriate speed were male. So it seems to be a bigger problem with male. The drink driving statistics are stubbornly high with older generations. Speeding and drugs, and sadly, driving without due care and attention is a big problem for younger people, primarily male, more than young girls. But anyway, without blinding you with statistics, Cynthia Ní Bhfiriciú joins me by WhatsApp. Cynthia, good morning.
Neil,
What is an interlocker, Cynthia?
Yes, well, an alcohol interlock device, it's essentially a breathalyzer in the car. That's the simplest way to explain it. It's a breath alcohol sensor device, a small, reasonably small device. It records breath alcohol concentration before the car can be started or the ignition can be started. And it requires the driver, obviously, to sit into the car and provide a breath sample for a test. And it ensures that the driver can start the car under the influence of alcohol.
And that would be for somebody who has already been convicted of a drink driving offence, and before after their term of suspension has expired, this must be fitted.
Exactly. A large part of the problem, as you've outlined there, Neil, in the introduction, it consists with this excess alcohol contributing to road deaths, not just in Ireland, but in Europe. It consists of a high risk of offenders reoffending. So they're breaking the law consistently and regularly, and they exceed the legal blood alcohol levels by a large amount. So it is part of the programme for rehabilitation. It is part of the programme for judges when they are handing down sentences to consider, and perhaps a lesser fine or a lesser ban, driving ban, in terms of time, months, years, could be considered if this is fitted to the car.
We know that nearly 40% of those killed in crashes, toxicology tests showed that alcohol was detected. So that's well over a third. How do you know that somebody, is there statistics that say that somebody who has once been convicted of drink driving is likely to do it again?
Yes, there is. And research has shown that in several countries in the EU that I'll come to. But just before we go to that, I don't want to blind, I suppose, the listeners too much or deafen them too much by statistics, because I'm acutely aware of road deaths. My own dad, unfortunately, was killed in a road traffic accident when I was just 16. So I understand the devastation and the trauma that is left behind. And as you said in the introduction, Neil, the statistics are off the charts. Thus far in this year, and we're only in the month of April, 64 people have lost their lives in road deaths. And that's not only drivers. There's pedestrians, passengers, there's motorists, and there's pedal cyclists. So this is a huge jump, and we've seen a huge jump of the overall figure from 22 to 23 of 19%. So look, 1 in 10 motorists have driven after consuming alcohol in the last 12 months, and these are figures now provided by the Road Safety Authority. And of those who admitted to consuming alcohol, the incidence, as you said, was highest amongst male drivers. It's 14%, but also those who drive for work, 14%. So this attitude of taking a chance, and also those with a history of collision involvement previously, 24%. But worryingly, Neil, is a percentage which is almost 1 in 3, 28% of this group that were surveyed by the Road Safety Authority, they admitted to having two or more drinks on the last occasion when they drove after consuming alcohol in the last 12 months. So this is an increase. People are now more likely to take a chance. And they feel, look, even though I have been drinking, one or two drinks won't do me any harm. I'll step into the car. So really,
that's actually something that is, to some extent, believed in rural Ireland, where they have crap road infrastructure. They have no transport system. You're referencing a statistic that says 1 in 10 Irish motorists admit to driving while having at least one drink in the last 12 months. Would that be rural, I wonder, in the sense that they can't get a taxi, they can't get a bus?
Sure. What one is likely to point rural Ireland, but I don't like to demonise any particular cohort of our citizens and our voters in this country without having the correct stats, you know, county by county, which I don't have in front of me. But I'm concerned, really, if you look at Cork, what I do have is some stats for Cork. In Cork City, the Garda intoxication testing checkpoints were down 15%. And that's between the years 22 and 23. And the Garda breath tests were down 12%. Now, that statistic is shocking when you consider the figures that you and I have been talking about in terms of the skyrocketing road deaths. So really what I'm asking for in the context of running for the European elections and running for a seat in the European Parliament is I really am backing calls by the European Transport Safety Council to mandate these alcohol interlocks in cars of convicted drug and drink drivers. So they should be in their cars. They should be fitted. Now, sorry, Neil, you asked me a minute ago about, you know, what is the experience? Does it work? The first thing is these interlocks do work. They are effective, they are cost beneficial, and they are also very efficient. So just to take a look at some of the experiences in other countries that people have heard about or read about. So several countries in the EU, such as Sweden and Finland and France and Belgium and the Netherlands, they have laws requiring the drink driving offenders to install these interlocks in their vehicles. And almost 1,200 drivers in Belgium, they're currently driving a vehicle that has been fitted with one of these. Now, that's after they've been convicted of driving under the influence. And in the Netherlands, a study showed that even after the block was removed, this is interesting now, the reoffending rate for those convicted with an alcohol interlock was 3 times lower than for drivers who
they learned
the conventional penalty.
They
learned their lesson.
Can you disable them, though?
To pay the fine.
Can you disable them? Can you disable them?
Look, I'm sure technology and everybody's up to every trick in the book about disabling, but disabling them is illegal. And if somebody is found out to have disabled this interlocker, and they shouldn't be able to do that if it's fitted properly, and it is fitted by an independent garage, an independent expert engineer, so they shouldn't be able to. But obviously, if they're found guilty of that, the penalty is even worse. So the message is, don't tamper with it. Install it if you want to get a lesser fine, if you want to get a lesser temporal ban on your driving, and you're depending on your car for a living, and adhere to not drinking at all when you're driving a car.
In Sweden, I think they're also, correct me if I'm wrong, putting interlockers into fleet cars, and they're putting them into trucks.
Absolutely.
For people in the workplace. They may have been never convicted of anything.
Absolutely. Yes, you're well up to speed, Neil. Yeah, they're used in government and company fleet cars in Sweden, and trials have been taking place in other countries as well. But just to go back to the trial, that's in the EU and actually in the US as well. But just to go back to the trial that ran in Sweden, which is very interesting. I was reading about that last night. Between 1999 and 2002 in Sweden, there was 300 alcohol interlocks installed in commercial passenger and goods transport. And subsequently, manufacturers such as Volvo and Toyota, they offered installation of the interlocks in trucks as a dealership option in Sweden. And one transport company in Sweden, they decided to equip all of their 4,000 vehicles, which was wonderful, with alcohol interlock systems before the end of 2006. And that has spread out to other types of transport companies and, as you said, government and fleet cars. So the Swedish Road Administration are very, very ahead on this and very keen on this. And more than 5,000 company cars in Sweden are today equipped with the alcohol interlocks.
Okay,
and
okay.
The number is growing rapidly.
Okay, but it would be an awful lot more effective as well, wouldn't it, if the amount of checkpoints hadn't been dropping. Apparently, I was reading in the paper this morning, checkpoints fell by 48% in the year to September of last year.
Yes.
That's very worrying. Is that because of a lack of Garda numbers or what?
Yes. Well, which or whether I certainly
it just means that if it's down for, if nobody sees a checkpoint, they're more likely because they go about their life and they never see. They're more likely to have a drink, aren't they?
I agree with you entirely, and I am calling on Minister Drew Harris to direct his policing management and authority in the direction of road safety. In fairness, I do read that he has directed all uniformed guards to conduct 30 minutes of road safety activity per shift, and that is being rolled out now. And obviously he has made this management decision given the sharp rise in traffic collisions. But you're quite right about visibility. The Commissioner said that the international policing partners, they utilise all police officers to focus an element of their shift in traffic management, the traffic environment. And obviously, as you have mentioned about visibility, this complements the increased visibility that we need and compliance by motorists. And we all know, Neil, as soon as we see a Garda car marked up, as soon as we see a speed van, as soon as we see any authority on the roads by way of a Garda Síochána, it has an effect on motorists and a positive effect.
Don't know about that. Road deaths per million in Ireland are up 29%. We are the worst performing in the European Union, and a lot of that has to do with speed. What are we going to do with regards to putting a restrictor in a car for speed? I mean, drink driving is one thing. What about speed? Fix that one.
Also looked at by Europe and by the European Transport Safety Council, and I would be promoting that as well. Obviously, a speed limiter is vital, not just for younger drivers. We see it. It has been rolled out by several insurance companies in Ireland as an incentive for reduced insurance costs for young drivers. I'm fully familiar with that. Having two children who learned to drive in recent years, it's extremely beneficial. But again, for people who are convicted of speeding, that should be part of the sentencing suite or the sentencing programme that a judge can impose, I believe. And that would be that a speed limiter would be fixed to the car. Look, the cost-benefit analysis of these proposals, interlocks, speed limiters, it's a no-brainer, Neil. A report was carried out for the Road Safety Authority by an institute called SWAV. They're based in The Hague, Netherlands. And they simply did a benefit-to-cost ratio and a net present value. And they found out that it's very efficient, very effective. Mm. And more importantly, the cost saving is somewhere astronomical. And I'm reading from the report now to make sure I get the figure right. It's between 19 million and 122 million. Because if we sit back and think about the costs of these road traffic accidents and fatalities and deaths from every aspect, obviously our civic authorities, our hospitals, our doctors, property damage, administration, congestions, emergency costs, it's phenomenal.
Okay, but you know, you talk about an interlocker for alcohol. Would that pick up cocaine? Would it pick up cannabis use?
As I understand it, the research and the development on the tech and the science is still undergoing some finessing. As I understand it, it should be coming on stream, and hopefully, because obviously drugs have a different effect on the blood and the bloodstream and the body, you can't use, as I understand it, the current interlock for the drug testing, but it is coming on stream, and it should be, because as you referred to in the introduction, cocaine is at epidemic levels in Ireland. We've the highest usage of cocaine in the European Union, and we've got the second highest of MDMA, ecstasy.
Why in the name of God do we have the highest cocaine use in Europe per head of capita? It's insane.
It's insane, but we all know, obviously, the drug cartels and obviously the government and the authorities are dealing with that. But I think, and you probably know this, Neil, and it's common knowledge that during the Celtic Tiger, cocaine became the drug of choice. And unfortunately, the curse of it and never the scourge of it has never actually lifted or reduced.
Yeah, I mean, there's a call. You know, you look at things like, you know, speed interlockers now for our drink interlockers and, you know, speed limiters and, you know, hate speech legislation and people who want to responsibly use drugs, whether it's cannabis legally or cocaine legally. I'm not suggesting heroin for a moment, but that there's this kind of big brother coming upon us more and more every day, you know, where to go, what to do, you know, how to think, what you should say, keep your mouth shut. Does that bother you at all that we're just being bombarded now with you know, what we're told to do and what we're told to say and how to behave?
Look, Neil, we live in a socially progressive society. We've come a long way in Ireland from the perspective of many things, whether it's women or people with different sexual persuasions or whatever. And it's right and proper that there is reasonable and proper debate about this. And as somebody who's running to win a seat in Ireland South in the European Parliament, I am keenly aware of voters who may be thinking of voting for me and wondering, well, what is this woman going to do? I adopt a positive, active, can-do approach. And if there's one thing, and today we're talking about road deaths, there are other issues that I'm campaigning on, but certainly on this, I believe a reasonable debate about everything. Everybody has a point of view, it should be listened to, but at the end of the day, when the stats on road deaths are frighteningly, as you say, off the charts, which I agree with, we do have to take very direct measures, and that's why I'm calling on the European Transport Safety Council to be backed to mandate mm-hmm. these alcohol interlocks in cars.
Okay, what have you been up to in all of these years, Cynthia? I mean, everyone will recall your past career as a broadcaster, journalist, very famously presenting Eurovision in, wasn't it, 94? That was the Riverdance yes. year, wasn't it?
That's right.
Become a junior counsel barrister working in the courts. Have you been very busy?
Yeah, to be honest with you, Neil, I have been solving problems 24/7 for the last, I don't know how many years. I've been working since I was, you know, 20, whether it's as a teacher or whether, as you say, in broadcasting or working as a family lawyer. And I have been consistently helping to solve problems, deal with issues. And I feel at this stage, with all of that experience behind me, I want to go on and try and solve further problems on a societal level and improve people's lives and shape a better future for people. And I think I have the skill set to do that. And I really would like, I mean, I'd be honoured and I'd really ask the voters to consider a vote for me because I am a person who likes to just have positive politics. Europe really matters. I'm certainly not part of any Euroscepticism. I do not want to go out there and vote no to everything. I want to go out and improve people's lives through legislation. Two other areas that I'm keenly interested in are obviously the EU directive on combating violence against women and domestic violence and also other forms of violence. And obviously the EU directive on the Digital Services Act, because I am keenly aware that our children's childhood has been taken away from them by the tech giants and by the lack of regulation.
Do you agree, therefore, that I was reading in the papers yesterday that there's a government proposal sooner or later that no child under the age of 14 will have a smartphone?
Yes, I have to say I want more dialogue on that. Obviously, there has to be a buy-in by the other partners involved, namely parents and schools and educators and all of that.
Isn't that more people dictating to us, though, telling us what we can do, what we can give our children, how we lead our lives?
No, I think the tech giants from a legal point of view should be regulated. Commission Yaman is tasked to do that as set up under the recent Digital Services Act in Ireland, which has been adopted from the EU. And I think with the correct laws in place, like we have drink driving laws, drug driving laws and all of that, we need laws in relation to how or when these tech companies can produce the technology to actually stop a child who puts in a false date of birth from setting up an account or from interfacing with content that is absolutely illegal and violent and bullying and full of content that no child should ever see.
Yeah, but if that was, that should be done before now. I mean, we have MEPs in Europe and we have the European Union and all the legislators. If there was a will to do that, there would have been a way already.
In fairness, Neil, the legislators in the European Parliament, the members of the European Parliament, have been working on the EU Digital Services Act for 5 years prior to it coming into effect in 2022. So that's only 2 years ago. And we now have our own national act in 2024. So I am calling for robust age verification for children who use the online social media accounts, and the tech giants will have to be made accountable for that under the law. And there's going to have to be criminal sanctions, as well as fines and investigations and reports and so forth, and taking down content. But there's got to be criminal sanctions for some of these company directors. I think that's what will make them sit up and take on their responsibility and realise that children have rights under the Constitution in Ireland and under several laws, and they have to be respected.
Okay.
They cannot just profit on the back of our children.
Which they are doing in billions. Cynthia, thank you for taking the call this morning. Good luck with the campaign. Cynthia Nivarco. Féin, Sláinte Fáil, Fianna Fáil candidate for MEP for Ireland South. What do you make of that? Interlockers in cars, primarily and initially, I suppose, for people who have been convicted of drink driving. You might find company cars might decide to do something like that, or somebody who has a fleet car, somebody who's driving a car owned by a company or what have you. So you got interlockers. How are you fixed? How do you feel on speed limiters and things like that? Text 0868104106. Without blinding you with science or tech or with statistics, that's an incredible figure that makes the mail this morning, that intoxication testing checkpoints, we call them drink driving checkpoints, fell by nearly 50% to September of 2023 in a year. So in one 12-month period, drink driving checkpoints down by 50%. It's insane, really. It's just not acceptable for whatever reason, and there probably are many. Lack of Gardaí would be a good place to start. You see the Examiner this morning, just as an example, Cork City, 61 fewer Gardaí than we had 2 years ago.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
Get involved. Text 0868104106. Get on the air. Pick up the phone, 0818104106. Kieran says, on the interlock devices for drink driving, most truck companies are using the system, so the vehicle can't be used unless a clear sample is given before allowing the truck to start. Thank you for that, Kieran. But where are you talking about? Most companies, most truck companies in Ireland? I'd love to hear more about that, please, if somebody isn't involved in the trucking business where they already have an interlocker. Are you saying, Kieran, in other European countries, most trucking companies are using those kind of interlockers? Bernadette says, are there any stats for morning after drink driving? I had a look at that. I couldn't find any stats for Ireland, but I did find, I'm sure they're there somewhere, but I couldn't find them at short notice. Thank you for your text, but I did find one for the UK. And it says the 20% of people who've been done for drink driving if you look at one particular year, which would have been 2022, 20% were caught the morning after. So I hope that answers your figure. Another per text here from texter who doesn't sign their name says checkpoints fell by 48% because all of the guards are policing matches and policing festivals, which should be privatised. That's an interesting one, because I was talking about that yesterday with the amount of Gardaí that were on duty, and it's not up to the guard to go where they have to go to where they're told, but there was dozens of them at Fitzgerald Stadium in Killarney at the weekend. I mean, like, dozens of them. And you would think, oh my God, that could be done privately, couldn't it? Kyle says, might remember wrong, but I believe if you're caught drink driving in Norway, the court can impose a requirement that any vehicle you operate needs a breathalyzer. Well, you are right. Scandinavia takes it very seriously already. In addition, there is a mandatory suspension of your license to drive, jail time if it's very bad, and a hefty fine. Aaron says, fantastic idea. Trust the government to add a vehicle breathalyzer device tax to every car as well. A vehicle breathalyzer device tax. Michelle says, great idea. However, I think people using phones is a bigger issue these days. Oh, God damn it. What a great point. I fucking completely overlooked that, chatting to Cynthia Navarro-Koo. We talk about an interlock for alcohol. We talk about a speed restrictor. What about, that's a shame now. What about some kind of tech that would just disable your phone? Well, I mean, not 100% disable your phone, but certainly disable your phone to be able to read or send texts. And I know that that should be less and less a problem, really, with people who have modern. You don't even have to have a modern car. You have a car now is 10 or 15 years old. It's got Bluetooth capability in it anyway. So there's no need to actually touch the damn thing, and you shouldn't be texting anyway. So that's another point. Sorry, thank you, Michelle. I overlooked that point. Well done. A fantastic idea, which should have been introduced long before now, given the unacceptably high amount of drink driving in Ireland. And that, sadly, continues. Why, oh why, is Ireland so far behind every other European country, especially with something as important and necessary because it saves lives on our roads? Something needs to be done, and fast. Interlocker is a good idea. Paul says, this is something that should have been done years ago. Anyone objecting to it should, by default, have one installed as well, as they are clearly guilty of driving under the influence but haven't been caught yet. As in, why would you disagree to it? Well, the interlocker would be for only somebody who's been caught and have been sentenced and found guilty of a drink driving offence. Quick one, actually, if I can get back to the phone lines, just this side of 10. John, good morning.
Good morning, Neil. How are you?
Jonathan says if they had interlockers in cars, the majority of the country would be off the road. Anyway, your thoughts?
Well, the thing is, what happens, like, if there's a couple of buddies out together and the guy that is the driver of the car, the owner of the car, is over the limit, but he gets one of his buddies to drive in, to blow into this device, and then sits behind the wheel and drives away. How do you stop that? How does that work?
Well, what you've got there is a moron, right? You have a total moron there who is sober and gets into the car of a drunk driver.
Well, sure, there's loads of them out there. I mean, we see the...
No, but just think about that. Who in the right senses would do that? Get into the car with a drunk driver?
Look at the situation which you just referred to there with the woman with the two smart kids in the car. She must be the biggest moron on the planet.
Well, she was doing 104 and a 50, so that makes her open to criticism.
Has she no respect not only for herself but other road users? I would actually go as far as to say when she was convicted there were two smart kids in the car. Those kids, to give her a good fright, those kids should be put into care for a
while. This is a driving offence. It's not a criminal offence.
Hang on a second. I mean, that's a speech. She was driving with two kids. She had no respect for herself, but definitely didn't. And not the children.
So the sober buddy blows into the interlocker alkalizer and the drunk driver drives off. Why doesn't the sober buddy drive the car?
Because the owner, the driver will say, look, it's my car, look, I want to drive. I mean, all right, I'm willing to drive after 4 or 5 points, and his buddy goes along with that. Yeah, the sober one. Look, there's only one.
But who does that? Who's sober in their full senses gets into the passenger seat of a car with someone who's had 5 or 6 pints? I'd say there's few enough people.
It's happening every day of the week, Neil, for the simple reason, like, you mean, you speak to guards and they'll tell you. Look, people are chancing it now because there's no roadblocks, especially in Northern Ireland, where there's not enough guards there. The only way that you'll stop the texting to me, which is an automatic ban, using your mobile phone, drugs or drink driving, right, no insurance, speeding, is you lose your licence for good. Set a date going forward, like the smoking ban, and say, on the 1st of November, anyone caught doing anything I've listed there, you will lose your licence and you will never get it
back. Well, I'm okay with that. I don't know how many other people would be.
Yeah, lose your licence, a chance you lose your job. Lose your job, you lose your home, right? But that's all on you, buddy. If that's not a deterrent, nothing will work.
What about if you did that for the second offence?
No, they should bring in the law now that this is it, set a date going forward, and anything I outlined there, I listed there, if you're caught doing any of those, when you're in charge of a vehicle, you're automatically banned for good. You'll never drive again.
Okay, let's see what people think about that. Text 0868104106. We'll pick it up after 10.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM. Conversation that matters.
A quick shout out to everybody that's going to be involved in the Pieta House Darkness into Light walk at 4 a.m. down in Passage. It's the Walk of Hope, Passage West. I want to give them a quick shout out because they're looking for people to get involved in it. You can register at the Passage West post office if you want to be part of it. It will start at 4 in the morning, Saturday week, the 11th of May, at Passage Soccer Club, and they'll walk into daylight and all for Pieta House. So Registration is open now at Passage West Post Office. Best of luck to all involved. My apologies. It's Saturday, the 11th of May, is Darkness into Light. So if you're in that area and you would like to walk, pop into the post office and get the deeds there, as the fella says. Text 0868104106. Pick up the phone on 0818104106. I feel physically sick today. Yesterday, the report of the court case surrounding that poor girl in Limerick Hospital who died, and that the place was clearly understaffed and underfunded. But yet, we find money to pay €1 million a month for Ukrainian pets with their own people dying like that. Don't get me wrong, we did the right thing in bringing refugees to help them, but not cats and dogs at our expense. We're a nation of absolute fools. I'm sorry to say I support this government and pay huge taxes annually, but my money is being abused like that, resulting in me not supporting the government in any upcoming elections. What are you saying, that you won't vote at all? If you don't vote at all, won't that even make the chaos even worse? And on the issue of driving up around Carr's Hill and the road to Carrigaline, yesterday I met a lorry with a shipping container up behind. I was up behind it, and I thought of that unfortunate lady who had that terrible accident on Carr's Hill. Is there any update on how she is? No, actually. And it's not that, that there isn't an update. I just don't have it. I haven't inquired. I can do so, but I know that she was in hospital and she was in a critical condition. But with the help and the care there, I'm hoping, that she will make a full recovery, or as best a recovery you can be, in spite of what she went through. Also, regarding that American lad, he's not a lad actually, he's a grown man with false passports. The only records that the Gardaí could find on him being here were from 1988, which is 36 years ago. He was effectively living off-grid and outside of the system. How is that possible for so many years? It makes you wonder how many more are here that we don't know about, off-grid for so long. And then many then on drink driving. How do you do a breath test for stupidity? Because every single time, that's what's killing people, stupidity. I 100% agree with that. You can fit the breathalyzer to the cars, but who says it's the person who will drive the vehicle has blown into the device? I know, there's ways around everything, but something needs to be done, whether it's drink driving, whether it is putting limiters on cars, whether it is disabling mobile phones, I don't know. These interlockers are useless. All you have to do is get your buddy to blow into it, or your partner. It's happening all the time here in trucks. Right, so there's a second text now saying that they're already fitted to trucks. Let's get somebody who can tell us a little bit more than that, more about that with regards to interlockers or restrictors in trucks. Text 0868104106, or pick up the phone if you've got a minute. Make the call, 0818104106. Just on the breathalyzer test in cars for people convicted of previous offences, what stops other people blowing into the breathalyzer? Like, say, a family household, a teenager blows into it instead of the adult who was drinking alcohol at home the night before, or was out the night before. Yeah, everything is open to abuse, for sure it is. How can I put this? If you're moronic enough to blow into it for somebody who is over the limit, then shame on you, even if you are a son or a daughter. Actually, I was talking with a mother recently, and she was making a very valid point to me with regards to her daughter, because sometimes you'd have carpooling, or you'd have different people bringing kids to sport or to matches or to school or home from school and stuff like that. And she has warned her daughter on a number of occasions. She says, if you're ever in a car with somebody and an adult is driving and they reach for their phone, tell them don't do that. It's dangerous. Now, the child possibly would say, yeah, but isn't that rude? But the mammy said, and when I was chatting with the mammy, she said, no, that's what you need to say. It's dangerous. Put your phone away. I totally concur with that. Just on those stats, obviously men are higher. More men drive than women. I've had this argument for a long time when it comes to insurance purposes. Most lorry drivers are men. Most van delivery drivers are men. Most taxi drivers are men, and so on. I would love to know the statistics if they did it in equal numbers for men and women, as in, I suppose, gender representation on the road does not explain the discrepancy, as the driver, it's 53% men and 47% women. Does that explain it to you? The driver divide is much closer than you think. 53% on the roads are men, 47% are women. Keep those texts coming. Text 0868 104 106. Back after the break.
Call Neil now. 0818 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Come back to issues regarding our roads, whether it's drink or whether it's drugs or whether it's mobile phones. Keep that coming. Text 0868 104 106. One thing, I've been looking forward to a conversation now with Dr. Mary Ryan in a couple of seconds, and a few different points are going to put to her. It's interesting listening, I hope, for you guys. But there was a study, I don't have the latest stats for Ireland, but I did see a study done in the UK with regards to gender pay gaps, and they looked at all of the different so this is the work that a man would do and a woman would do, clearly doing the very same work and just as competently, but unfortunately find huge big differences in gender pay gaps, and they go right up to the top of the tree, if you like, up to barristers and judges, where there's like a 30% difference in what a female would be paid to a male. And then they go into financial managers and businesses and directors and businesses in the UK, where there's a staggering 29% less being paid to the woman doing the same job as the man. And then into areas like tech, web design professionals, there's a 27% pay gap. People working in production, factories, assembly work, stuff like that, 26% less money paid to women, even down to things involving education or nursery education or the teaching professions can be anywhere in and around 20% less. So I wonder why that gap is still as wide as it is between men and women. But the gap between men and women is quite wide in many different ways. I was to give you two typical examples of things that we've been dealing with recently on air. It has to do with, say, the relationship between a man and a woman or the work that a woman does. Do you remember the email? Myself and my husband have been together for 15 years. Since moving in and getting married, I can't notice but how selfish and self-centered he really is. Remember that email? I got a great response last week. I am a stay-at-home mum by choice because of, you know, bills and childminder fees and everything. But my husband doesn't think I need any me time because he says to me, you're home all day. He says he's out of work all 5 days a week and he's got hobbies at the weekend. She said he's rarely at home. When he does, he complains about how stressful it is to be home. I found myself at this stage lost in my life and I don't know what to do about it. Don't have any hobbies, don't have many friends, don't have opportunities to get out. Now, this man said to his wife, the idea for, he says of me, you know, if you want to get a break, you do get a break. You go shopping on your own. I mean, that's a very... you know, unkind and, you know, cruel thing to say. So this woman does all the cooking, the cleaning, the laundry, the shopping, the school runs. She says, I now end up feeling deflated and unsupported. He always makes my views seem invalid and small. I can't talk to him about any of your concerns. Do you remember that email? The child has special needs, and every time that the wife tries to bring it up, the husband rushes under the carpet and says, you're overreacting, you're overreacting. Now, there's a big response to that, and I wanted to come back to it. I received another one then, which I'll come back to later on, and has to do with the relationship with a partner for a number of years, where the mother-in-law is an issue. She is so controlling, and her partner, as in her husband, is so emotionally dependent on the husband, it's now at the point where it is unhealthy. So there's a lot to unpack there. To unpack that and some other issues as well, Dr. Mary Ryan. Mary, good morning.
Good morning, Neil, and thank you for having me on. How are you?
I'm good. What do you make of, say, that email within the relationship where you have a woman with no me time, no hobbies, no friends?
My ears were burning, Neil, when you were telling me, okay, when you were calling it out. It's dreadful. But I've heard that over the years, and that's one of the reasons I've spoken out about empowering women and trying to educate women and men that this is not acceptable. I mean, it's horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous. And I see it every day of the week. I have women coming in telling me those stories and sharing those stories with me. And it's one of the reasons that their hormonal health is actually, it's one of the reasons they're in with me. Because their hormone control center is exhausted, because they're overdoing it. But
you'd sum that up then in two words: burnout and exhaustion. Is it?
Totally, and a lack of self-worth. So I would turn it the other way. If what women have to do and what we have to bring into society is self-worth and self-love to women. So if a man was at home and a woman was coming home saying that, he wouldn't take it off her because he'd be empowered, or you'd hope he was empowered. I would want that woman just to, in a lovely way, say, darling, I'm doing a full day's work here. You know, I need my time. And off she goes and does her yoga and does her meditation and meets her friends and says, darling, the dinner is in the oven there. Make, you know, get the rota going and make sure the kids do what is on the rota. You know, it's up to women and men to stand up for themselves, put the boundaries in place, and don't take a sitting down like generations of women years ago did, like our mothers and grandmothers did.
But there's an interesting point. If these men are behaving in this way, which isn't playing ball or pulling their weight, isn't it the men's mothers who taught them that?
Well, that we're educating mothers now and fathers not to bring up their boys and girls equally. It's really important. We can't do the blame game here because we're all conditioned by the way we're reared. But with the insight and the knowledge, I'm asking mothers in particular to bring up their boys and girls equally, but also fathers to bring up their boys and girls equally. And we say that this lack of equality of how girls and boys are brought up all of the time, right across inheritance, across all you know, spheres. So we need, you know, fathers and mothers to realise that your lovely little girl and your boy that you have are equal and they need to be brought up equally. And that's in the sports field, where I had an under 16 year old girl in last week, and her mother went to drive quite a distance. She was a County Camogie player, drive quite a distance to play a challenge match, and she couldn't see it because the floodlights weren't on. But the under 15 boys match had floodlights, but the girls didn't get it. That's not good enough. And that's been happening for years, and the pay gap that you were talking about, journalists have been talking about that for 20 years. Nothing is happening. So really,
but those pay gap figures I gave there, which are UK based, forgive me, would they be comparable in Ireland?
I'm sure they are, Neil. I don't know. All I know is every time I pick up a paper, I see it time and time again. And I suppose we all get irritated at things coming up because I'm a doer. So I'm somebody that gets on and does it. If I see a problem, I fix it.
Why would women who are doing the same work as competently as a man be paid disproportionately less for the same job?
Yeah, well, it's very, very wrong. But I suppose the government also need to make sure that they need to insist that this no longer happens. And at the end of the day, these people should be, you know, taxed extra if they do that, or pay more PRSI if they do that. You know, there has to be a punishment if that goes on, because it's not acceptable in today's age. It's just not acceptable. Okay. It should never have been acceptable, but it's never acceptable. And unfortunately, what people don't realise is this seeps down into the psyche of women. It seeps down that they think they're not worthy, that they don't have the confidence to stand up for themselves and to think that they're equal and act as if they're equal and actually stand up and go out and do what I said that woman should do. And don't even, if he's shouting after her, just keep walking. You know, and if he sulks when she comes home, let him get over it. It's about realizing you've only one life, you're equal, and that your health is important and your personal space is important. And that's not selfish. And in fact, if you feel guilty, which so many Irish women do, guilt means we don't love ourselves enough. And I'm fed up of telling women, you've got to mind yourself, you've got to look after yourself, eat healthily, get time for exercise, get time for sleep. And they say, I feel guilty. And I say, guilt, what's this all about? You have to love yourself, because otherwise it affects your hormonal health.
They feel guilty of what?
Guilty of not doing things, guilty of not being there for their children, guilty of walking out for their walk for fear their children won't get fed properly, guilty for going out meeting their friends because they think the husband won't do it the same as them and that the dinners won't be given to them properly or that the lunches won't be made, all this sort of thing.
And did you ever look at that and see, is that learned behaviour that they saw with their own mothers, or is it something that we need to unpick instinctively within the genes?
I think it's a combination. I think it's a combination of women being disempowered because of the way we're being treated in society. We're still not treated equally. I think that's seeping down. Women's sport, I was listening to Morning Ireland yesterday with all the fantastic matches we had at the weekend. And, you know, they barely mentioned the TG Cahar, what happened on the women. There was a huge, big 10-minute spree on the men, but hardly anything on the women. That's not fair, because we women are paying tax, you know, on RTE fees just as much as everybody else. So that's not fair. And then you have all the other stuff, like the pay inequality you mentioned, the sports thing we mentioned. So all that needs to change.
So this could be a woman who also is a mother and a wife who is working and co-parenting children, but doing... Okay, so there's a lack of confidence for the woman then who's a mother in the workplace to stand up and say, I'm worth more pay. And they also have a lack of confidence where you're saying 50-50 doesn't exist when it comes to housework and child rearing.
Exactly. And I think a lot of women too are fearful of causing, you know, fighting in the home with the children there. That's what I hear a lot. That I say to him, why don't you just gently say, darling, I need to go? And he say, oh, but he'll be irritable and he'll be taking it out on me and the children and there'll be an atmosphere in the house. And I suppose, again, that comes where, you know, you well within your own power to say, darling, I need to go, and out you go. And I think it's just giving women the confidence that they're entitled to their own life. They've only one life. They've got to live it to the best of their ability. And in doing so, they're mentoring their boys and their girls who are looking at them. And their girls are saying, well, this is the way I'm going to behave when I get older. And the boys are going to respect women and you know, do what the... You really respect the relationship. And it leads for a much better society going forward.
And the women that you're talking about, are they women who are like that email that I had, who actually is working in the home? She's the homemaker. Yeah. She is the...
Totally, Neil.
Or is it those that are also juggling a job?
It could be both, Neil. I see it all the time. It's both. I've got a little sheet, consultation sheet, that I get patients to fill out when they come in, and I always have what they're doing. And I would say, they would at home, and I'd say, oh, you're working in the home. And they would say, well, no, I'm just in the home. And I say, excuse me, you're working in the home. I said, to pay you and to look after all the children, it would cost a fortune. So I always find that to the majority of the women, I have to correct them and I have to tell them, you actually are working, value yourself, you know. But I would see it also, Neil, in women that are juggling. So you'd see it right across the board. And it's one of the reasons that we have to empower women more and get them to love themselves more and get them to realise they've only one life, that they're equal, but to act like that and to demand the equality, to actually demand it with huge power if we only used it.
Okay, talk up is what you keep saying this morning. But does money then play a factor in this? In a household, say, where the man is the earner of the cash or the main earner or earns more, does that give him a more domineering or a dominating position?
Yeah, it shouldn't though, because you now have situations where some of the women bring more in than the men, and I have a lot of patients like that, and thankfully for the majority, you know, that they're getting on very well. But you'll always hear of the odd story, where unfortunately the money might be a factor. But hopefully that's lessening now, that women are working, and if they're not working, they've got to value themselves of the excellent job they're doing in the home, at managing the home, managing the children and managing everything that goes on. So I think it's about a value. Women have to value themselves, whether they're working outside of the home or in the home. They've got to value themselves. And really, money shouldn't come into it. It should be where you're in a relationship, you've brought these children into the world, you're doing the best you can in a very busy, busy, hectic environment, and everyone should be pulling their weight.
And how does it then impact on a woman's health? You talk about burnout and exhaustion.
Yeah. So we see the typical story would be, you know, a mother that gets up at 6 o'clock, she tells from me time, she then, gets on and puts on the breakfast. This is a story I heard only yesterday, actually. Gets on the breakfast, leaves the husband in bed. Then she gets the three children out. They're all in their teens. She makes their lunches. She drops them all off. Then she goes to work. Then she comes back in the evening. She's the exact same thing again. She washes up, does everything.
And so then your man gets up, has his breakfast and legs.
Absolutely, and goes off to the. And I'm not saying that's all men, but this is the case from yesterday. And she was into me, and she was complaining of being exhausted. She had a thyroid issue, and basically, when I was asking her, I said to her, "Why is it that you didn't ask your husband to help out and didn't get your teenage kids to empower them to do their own lunches? They're well able to do them. They're going to be doing them in a few years anyway. And why don't you get a rota going where they can do all the jobs in the evening, and you sit down and get some valuable time with your husband where you can chat instead of passing each other by?" And she sort of looked at me as if like that was, you know, ridiculous. And I said, well, unless your hormone control center gets recharged, right, I can control your thyroid, but you also have to let that do what it's supposed to do. So our hormone control center controls all our muscles and our immune system and our thyroid. And we have a duty to nourish it, to rest, to plug in, and not to overdo it. Because once you overdo it, the hormones go off, the immune system goes off, and then it will attack your thyroid and any other organ that it wants to. So we have a responsibility to actually look after ourselves. And women are not good at that. And they need to. And I think you're right. It's conditioning from generations. But, you know, now that there's so much talk about self-love and self-worth, it's up to women to do it.
So you mentioned a lot there. If you just unpack part of that, it's biological, it's physiological. But does it impact on, you know, happiness or sleep or attitude to life? Or does it lead to depression?
Yeah, well, you see, if we all get overtired, Neil, and our hormones are off, then hormones control all muscles. So therefore, you don't go into deep muscle relaxation. So therefore, you're not getting enough sleep. The other thing we find is that if hormones are off, hormones control bowel muscle as well. So the circadian rhythms are off everywhere in the bowel. You have aches and pains in the muscles. You might have headaches. And of course, it's going to affect your brain function, memory, if you get overtired and it becomes a vicious circle. So that's why it's so important. And yes, of course, mood can be affected, but it's not depressed. And women traditionally with menopause and perimenopause, just because they felt tired, they were all fobbed off as being depressed. The reason people that have endogenous depression, and I my heart goes out to them, but in an awful lot of women, they're actually, it's just hormone imbalance from a heavy period. And if the heavy period along with overdoing it, you're going to really get a hormone imbalance, menopause.
Doctors for way too long, and I don't even know if it's still the case. If a woman presents like that, burnout or hormonal issues or lack of sleep or mood or irritability, they give them antidepressants.
Well, we're changing that, Neil. And I suppose the reason was that women's health was never dealt with. I mean, when I started all this menopause talk 10 years ago with Lorraine Keane, and I went around the country lecturing about it, trying to create, because I'd heard all these dreadful stories of women suffering, and women's health was completely left behind. And I wasn't even taught it in Trinity College where I went. So I had to self-educate. So that was one of the things that was left behind. And that's why, we're only talking about periods of menopause now, even though Adam and Eve was around generations ago. So I suppose that's one of the reasons that women's health was left in the doldrums, and we're now bringing it on. And the last 10 years, we really have got it to where it should be. And now women are hearing what periods are and what a normal menopause and what a normal perimenopause is and what they need to do to look after their hormonal health. And I would hope that with this, we'll also be talking about men, and we'll make sure we don't leave men behind either. I think it's very important.
Well, men have hormones too, Mary.
Yeah, this is it. So that's my point. So I in doing so, I will be educating men as well about all their hormones and about, because I don't want, if men burn out, they can equally get thyroid disease and get all of the things. For example, long COVID is COVID infecting the hormone control center. We had that with patients who got glandular fever, who got a bad viral illness in endocrinology for years. So anyone that gets overtired, their immune system is affected because hormones control the immune system. If then they're more susceptible to picking up the virus that nobody else would pick up. That's a secret.
Just looking there again, just before I let you go at that email, and I have others like that, but she says that she has been trying continuously, say this woman whose husband just doesn't seem to see the big picture here, and she says that she is fed up of continuously having the same argument over and over again.
Well, tell her to stop arguing. She'll be wasting energy. You will never change people. You change yourself. So what she's got to do is, if she has children, get them to operate the rotor. She's empowering them to do that. I lost my husband 11 years ago. I had three young children. Got the rotor going, and that was the one thing. So it's empower them. It knocks off the corners. They come in the evening. They wash up. They do the dishwasher, the works, and everything is on the rotor that I can possibly put on.
But he'll say, I've been out working all day. I'm tired.
No, so all she needs to do is say, darling, your thing's in the oven there, help yourself and make sure they get the rotor going. I want the kitchen clean when I come home and I'm off out for my walk. And she goes. That's what she's got to do.
And if an argument ensues, does she stick to her gun?
Don't react. What are you going to achieve with an argument? All she has to do is say, I did this for myself. I need to do this for myself. Always do I, and then she'll be fine. It's no point arguing. You're not going to change him, but she can change herself. And she's got to work on changing herself and realizing she's only one life and she needs to live it to the full. And in doing so, she's going to mentor her children brilliantly. And she's got to realize now that today she takes her first step in loving herself and going forward. No arguing. Just go forward, live her own life. Dot out what she wants to achieve in life and achieve it. That's what she's got to do.
Okay.
And hopefully he'll come with her. He will. In the majority of cases,
and
he will.
And if he doesn't,
well, do you know what? She has only one life. Would she want her daughter or son to be in the same position? No, she wouldn't. And we don't want any marriages breaking up. But Neil, you've only one life and you can't. That situation is stressful. If you have constant tension in a house, it's no good for anyone. So the best way is to, and maybe she needs to get a bit of counselling as well, just to help her be more positive. There's great counsellors, psychotherapists there, psychologists there. I would recommend that for her as well.
Do you think that in a relationship, I don't know how to generalize this, that women who marry men are kind of marrying their mothers.
Yeah, well, that's said, and it's said that we marry our fathers. But I suppose, you know, we all do our best and none of us are perfect. We've got to remember that. But, you know, when there is a problem, and there's always going to be a problem in all relationships, there's no relationship perfect. But, you know, we all do our best and we compromise. And I always point out to patients, I deal with patients in their 80s as well and 90s, and they're totally dependent on each other. And it's wonderful. And I remember one patient coming into me a few weeks ago, and himself and his wife had an awful time 15 years ago that I remember them telling me about. And then he was in praising his wife on this occasion. And I said, do you remember the last time that you were bickering and you were fighting and you were saying you were going to walk out? And I said to you to hold back and go for counselling and see could you pull it? Because I knew there was that you really got on well behind the scenes. And he said, thank God I did, because he said we're the best of pals now. And he wasn't in good health and she was totally beside him and helping him. So, you know, there's an awful lot of pluses to hanging in there, provided both are compromising and both are working it. But if there's one, you know, not pulling their weight, it's very difficult.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. You're on Lee side this Sunday. I think you're in the Radisson Blue and Little Island, Empowering Women. Yes. What's that one about?
Empowering Women. So it's all about navigating your hormones. So it's talking about periods to menopause. Menopause. We'll be talking about men as well, Neil, don't worry. And we're going to talk all about thyroid disease, fertility, infertility, endometriosis. We've great consultant cardiologist, Dr. Nasa Starr, who's talking about heart health. We have Dr. Julie O'Brien, a radiologist from Cork, actually, and she's going to talk about osteoporosis and bone health. And then we have Rachel Graham talking about nutrition. We have Jennifer Earls, who's a fantastic girl doing yoga and Pilates and exercise from Cork as well. We have Dr. Fiona Barry, who will be interviewing on stage.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And we also have Pamela, who will be interviewing on stage all about hair. So okay. I'm really, really looking forward to it. And I forgot to mention Lorraine Keane, who will be there with the panel. And I forgot to mention Una O'Hagan, a fantastic pharmacist who's a huge interest in women's health. And she will be also giving a lecture. So it's going to be an amazing day, lunch included, tea included, and just an empowering event.
Okay, this Sunday, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. So it covers a lot of ground
and
over those 5 or 6 hours. It's Eventbrite.
The link is in my bio, in my Instagram, yeah.
Well done, eventbrite.com, and also further details on Dr. Mary Ryan's social page. And Mary, thanks for catching up. Appreciate
You're so
it.
Welcome,
good luck on
Leo.
Sunday.
Not
Take care
at all.
Yourself.
Take care. Bye.
Navigating your hormones, empowering women this Sunday, April 28th, 9 in the morning to 3 p.m. at the Radisson Blue Little Island, eventbrite.com. For tickets. More on this after the break. Text 0868 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
Be part of the conversation, the Neil Prendeville Show with Mercedes-Benz Cork. So that's an interesting one. Call it the mother-in-law conundrum, if you like. Email says, I've been in a relationship with my partner for quite a number of years. Now, we shared this on social last night, so I have some responses from people who follow me on social. Been in a relationship with my partner for a number of years. From the beginning, his mother has been an issue. His mother is very emotionally dependent on my husband in a very unhealthy way. She always treated him and continues to treat him like her husband. Bizarre. Not a son, but like her husband. When we first started dating, she would ring and text constantly, asking him where he is, who he's with, when he'll be back, and even telling him to come home now. If she felt he was out too late, she would say, come home now. When he stayed with me at weekends, she'd tell him he had a bed in her house and that's the only bed he should be sleeping in. We eventually got engaged, moved in together. I thought that everything would soon be normalized, but things just got worse. She would ring every day, the same conversation repeated over and over again. Even after all these years, she would say he could come home whenever he wants if things aren't going well. After tiptoeing around the subject, I told my husband he needs to set boundaries. He is distancing himself, yes, from her, but still she's got her hands wrapped around him. She's like a dark cloud looming over our marriage. She calls almost every day. I feel I'm not being treated like a wife. He tells me things when they come up in conversation, but he'd already have told his mother days prior. I feel like I'm always giving out about his mother or trying to make him see that she's too dependent on him. I'm wondering if I'm overreacting or what should be my next move. I don't want to leave him. He's the love of my life and he treats me so well. That's kind of interesting. You're right, actually, when you talk about setting boundaries, really, aren't you? And one of those boundaries would be that if he wants to talk to his mother on a daily basis, that's fine. And I suppose to some extent, it's his own business if he wants to talk to his own mother. But let it be at a time when certainly you're not there, or he does it in his own time, or he does it outside of the home. So you're not witnessing it all the time. It's not kind of constantly the same thing over and over again, him on the phone to his mother at home. I mean, he's probably close to his mother and he loves his mother. And maybe, I don't know, is he an only child? You know, you talk about his mother. Is his father alive or is his father dead? Maybe she's all alone in the world and the only contact she has really with any of her loved ones is her son. I mean, she is an over-demanding mother, for sure she is. And she's certainly this business of you have a bed here if everything goes wrong. I mean, that's not the kind of normal conversation that a mother would be having with a son. I'm assuming you've had conversations with him in the past about, you say, I've told him that he needs to set boundaries. Kathleen says, what's going on at all between bad husbands and bad mother-in-laws? There seems to be a common denominator. The common denominator every time is the men. Mammy's boys, the lot of them. And you can bet that he loves the attention. She probably does a lot for him too, so he's delighted to have a wife and a mammy looking after him. She'd be hard-pressed to change this. Best of luck trying. It's too late, says Kathleen. Well, an ultimatum also wouldn't be a bad idea. And I wonder if the wife who got in touch with me, let us call her Mary, because she doesn't want her details given out. Have you ever had a conversation with your mother-in-law? You know, just to sit down, chat as to, you know, the state of play and where things are at. How would the mother-in-law react if you were to address it directly with her? Melissa says, oh God, I couldn't put up with that. You need to find her own man. Sign her up for First Dates Ireland or else send him packing back to his mammy. Somebody that just wouldn't tolerate it at all there. Melissa, Teresa says, that's a weird, unhealthy mother-son relationship for sure. Mother-in-law needs a hobby, I think. Philip says, it sounds like favourite child syndrome to me. Is there such a thing? Favourite child syndrome. For me, boundaries need to be set, and they need to be set by him to his mother. As in, he's the one needs to have a sit down. I don't think the mother has ever let her son go, really, you know. She's never cut the apron strings. She probably always sees him through the prism of a child. Anyway, keep those coming. Text 0868 104 106.
Text or WhatsApp Neil now. 0868 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
I'll talk to Michael in a second. I promise I'll get to calls. I was just thinking a lot more about this. One or two other texts on this say, Molly said, I had this with my ex. He lived across the road from his mam, yet she rang him all the time and he'd go to her for dinner and she'd do all his washing. Mammy's boys never change. Run and find a real man, says Molly. So he'd go over, would he have two dinners then or what was it? Where was the dinner always in the mam's? And he'd bring his washing over. That's very unhealthy. But also, let's be honest about this. Women also could be, if this is something one would be found guilty of, and maybe that's a strong word to use, women also can be very attached to their mothers. And sometimes, in some cases, when they grow up and they marry and they settle down, they don't actually stray all that far from where mammy is. And that's a loving relationship. I mean, you know, it's taken to extremes. It's not. It's unhealthy for the relationship with your partner. But there are many women as well who are very, very close and very attached to mam. My son had the same problem, has the same problem. He is his mother's only friend. And she, let me see if I can follow this. My son has the same problem, says Pat. He is his mother's, oh yeah, I understand now. He is his mother's only friend, and she has broken up, or was part of the reason he broke up with a long-term girlfriend. Always interfering in his life, even to the point we haven't spoken for 5 years. You argue with her, he's on her side, and vice versa. So get out of that relationship, because mummy's boys never change. Mark says, you can set all the boundaries you want. This dynamic ain't ever going to change. And both Liz and Mary say, run, I know all about it, run ASAP. And Mary says, run and keep running. And final one for now, this sounds so familiar. I once dated a guy who had his very own separate mobile phone that his mother would ring him on every single night at 9:30 p.m. The mammy phone, he called it. I myself called it the bat phone. Batty mother, more like. Needless to say, the relationship didn't work out, and I'm thankful that it didn't. So that's a real extreme, where a guy actually had a specific, separate mobile phone just for his mother. the mammy phone, or as she called it, the bat phone. Keep them coming. Text 0868 104 106. As promised, I'll get as many calls in again as I can today. Michael, good morning.
Hi.
Can you hear me okay? I'm good, thank you. How's that line for you? Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfect, yeah.
Okay, it's a bit wishy-washy. We'll see how we go. Michael, you're in Cork now, eh? But were you born in London?
I was born in London, yeah.
Okay, how long ago was this?
1971.
In 1971. And when you were born, was it directly after your birth that you were handed over for adoption or for a mother and baby home back in Ireland, was it?
Well, it was kind of...
I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to put you back there because WhatsApp is usually very reliable. At this point, it's not very reliable. So as soon as the phone line clears up, I'll come back to you in a couple of times. Maybe flip it to a regular phone line and I'll be able to have a chat with them at that point. For all of the business, text 0868 104 106. Pick up the phone on 0818 104 106. Interesting update there with regards to the interlockers, because one of the big pushbacks from you guys so far was that somebody else would blow into it, and then the driver who's drunk or who has drink on board will be able to drive because a sober passenger blew into the interlocker. Kieran says, if someone has bypassed the interlock using someone else to do it for them, then they should get 10 years in prison straight away, no arguments. This will deter anyone to risk it, and the passengers should get the 10 years prison as well. That way, people would be reluctant to do it for anyone who has been drinking. The issue there, of course, is some people who drink and drive get away with it. And if we have 48% less checkpoints on our roads last year than maybe the 2 years previous to it, then people are willing to take more and more of a chance if they know that there's less and less checkpoints out there. Of course, it's very different if, for instance, you are stopped and you're drunk behind the wheel and there's an interlock in the car. Then you and the passenger who blew into it, Kieran is saying, should both get jail. But it would be impossible to prove that it was the passenger that blew into the interlocker. It could have been another person who got out of the car from the back seat earlier. It could have been a stranger. You wouldn't be able to prove that. How would you get that across the line? Anyway, keep them coming. Text 0868 104 106. Michael, morning again. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you better. I can hear you perfect.
Okay, my friend. So I'm interested to hear your story. Back in the 70s, you were born in London, but your mother wasn't in a position to keep you as a baby. Is that right?
That's correct. She had another sibling a year previous. But
have you an indicator on there, Michael?
I turned it off, do you know.
Are you say, is it safe to turn it off?
No, it is off. I'm going.
Okay, go ahead. Tell us your story.
But basically, it's all cropping up now. It didn't just seem all these investigations are cropping up now. We say adoption thing is coming up again now, and you would like the Stardust and you would like the Whitty Island thing. It's 40 years down the line. Like,
yeah, well, the thing about it is the redress scheme for babies and people who are born in mother and baby homes, that they should get some financial.
But I didn't know anything about that until somebody told me yesterday. There was a program on another radio show, and I didn't hear it. But
it was also, it was possibly this show, because we did a lot of detail on it. I spoke to people who were in mother and baby homes. You only get a payout depending on how long you were in the mother and baby home.
I didn't know anything about that last weekend.
Okay.
And okay. It was just a cousin or a friend of mine that.
The point I'm trying to make is
that I'd love to know how they were treated. Do you know what our parents would say?
How do you mean?
Back in the day.
Yeah.
Back in the day, you know. Like, I only had the opportunity to meet my maternal mother once.
And that was about 8 years ago, wasn't it?
That's what I say, yeah.
And how did that meeting go with her?
Fabulous.
And what did she tell you? What did she talk about?
I sure, it was mainly about hugs.
Hugs. Lovely hugs.
Yeah, basically.
Delighted to see you, to meet you.
Yeah, it was once off, and she was sick at the time, you know.
Did you recover?
So I don't know.
You don't know. Okay. So you met. Did you search her for her and find her?
I did, yeah.
Was she in Ireland? Was she in the UK?
No, she was in Ireland, yeah.
Right.
She had to go to the UK to basically, she was probably forced to the UK to have me. You know, it was, I suppose it was looked down on at the time, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Many did go to the UK.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, many did.
Yeah, yeah.
But I know there was a lot of hugs and a lot of love, but did you manage to unravel any of the, you know, story of her life or the story of your life? Did you chat about anything like that?
Yeah, look, there was other siblings there that I have never met.
Very emotional meeting then.
But like, I suppose, you know, she didn't want to get through to it because this was news to her and it was news to me and it was, I had a half sibling with me as well.
Yeah. But one thing is for sure, she was delighted to meet you.
Oh, yeah, totally. But, tis the thing, like, how were they treated back in the day, you know?
Very badly. Very, very badly.
Very badly, yeah.
Sometimes it was their mothers and fathers that drove them out for the shame of it.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was the parish priest came around and drove them out.
Totally.
Some of them wanted to keep their babies and they were taken off them.
But the whole thing is that, like, tis the whole establishment at the time, like.
Yeah.
And, like, as you said, they are the parish priests, they were the main men at the time, like.
That's right. It was as if people lived in fear of the priest, or they lived in fear of the guard, or they lived in fear of the politician, or they lived in fear of what the neighbours would say.
Yeah. Teacher and all this. But it's just haunting.
It's haunting for you to think how your mother was treated back then when she was pregnant with you and banished to London to have a baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can't get over that. You can't get over that hurt upon her.
But it's... they're bringing it up now again with this redress, but, like, there's no money will replace that, like.
I know.
So why are they doing it now? 50 years later, with a...
Well, better late than never to put things right.
Oh, but I know, but like, sure, look, it's coming up to election in this, I suppose.
Well, you know, the cynic in me would agree with you there too, to an extent, you know, but like...
It always happens, like, you Wheaty Island now was coming up, it's around the same time as well, that was 79, wasn't it?
Much of that money that was made for adoptions were literally, unfortunately, I have to say, children and babies were sold, and there was a price put on them, sometimes to Irish couples, sometimes to Americans. And that money was kept by the church. That money was kept by religious orders. And they were very slow to divvy it up then when they were found to be wanting.
But Neil, I couldn't... I have no regrets with the parents that I was adopted to. But what I'm thinking is just about the fear just what they went through.
I understand exactly what you're saying. You are very upset about the hurt and the anguish and the fear that your birth mother went through. I understand what you're saying.
Yeah,
I do. Yeah. And can I ask you, why was there no other meeting since 2016? If both of you, I think you're in Cork and she's somewhere else in Ireland, why didn't you keep up meeting?
Because I'd say that it was probably stressful for my birth mom, you know. She met two of her sons in one day.
So not only you went for adoption, but a brother as well.
Yeah, but she met the two of us in the one day, like.
Yeah, yeah.
At the same time.
Would you like to have stayed in touch with her?
It would have been too complicated, Neil, I suppose. You know, not for me, but for her, because she went on to have another family, you know.
Yeah. Did you have medical issues that you weren't able to resolve, that you weren't aware of because you didn't have a medical history?
That's one of my issues. Like, every time I go to the doctor now, and I was only told last night from a friend, I'm allowed to get a medical card.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. And I'm after spending about 20 grand on medical bills with the last so many years, I don't know. And it annoys me as well that there's people able to walk in the door here now at the minute and they're able to get medical cards and PPS numbers. And I had to immigrate a couple of times. Well, I didn't have to. I wanted to. But, like...
There's a lot of disquiet in Ireland over issues like that. There is. But
when I came back here, I had an awful job trying to even get, you know, any bit of help at all. But so I have an Irish passport, and I should have been able to get things sorted straight away.
Well, based on whatever your income would be, you would be or wouldn't be entitled to a medical card. Is your income, are you working now? Do you work all your life?
I did most of it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm working now. But like, the thing about it is that I know I've been told that with this new thing with adoption that I'm entitled to a medical card. I'm entitled to a few more things. I didn't even look into it yet properly.
Yeah, well, you should. If you've been shut out.
No, I'm going to. But like, the thing about it is, this is all new to me. But like, it's still the thing that they went through.
The mothers. Yeah, the young girls. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and the fathers too, I suppose. You know. They probably got a front up in the hole, and they were told not to come back again.
Listen, there would be loads and loads of different scenarios going on. You know. There was a man's role in it as well, and sometimes they would have been quite young, you know, young boy.
Yeah, they might have been in love, like.
But if you had a baby and you weren't married back then, boy, that was taboo.
Yeah. Oh no, totally. But like, so look, Christ, when you look at the population over this country at the minute, like, a lot of people aren't married at all.
And no, that's a different time.
You said one day 48% of them.
Yeah, it's totally different now.
And they're not married.
Yeah.
And look, there's no hassle, is there?
Fear of authority. It was just a different world. It was ruled by fear. Fear and damnation.
I rang up one day inquiring about it, and going back before that time now, like, I was searching for a long time, and I was told all them files got destroyed in the fire. And I was talking to a reverend mother. I know her name, but I'm not going to say it. But like, she was ignorant down the phone to me. She says, "What do you want them for?
What do you want to find out who your mother was for?" Yeah, that's what you were up against.
No, I just wanted to know exactly when I was put in there, and when. Basically, I was took out of it, and I was told, "You've no business on that anyway. You're bones. The files are bones."
Yeah.
Like, there was a lot of corruption back then.
Yeah. Were you in the mother and baby home for longer than 180 days?
I think so.
Yeah, because that's the cap they've put on it. You needed to have been in there for 180 days in a row to be part of the redress payment scheme. It's very cruel.
I think that's very cruel
on a baby who was there 179 days or 50 days or 70 days, but they seem to
I'm
think
not
it's
positive,
different.
No, but look, it was so hard to get an adoption cert and your original birth cert. And like, I have a birth cert from London, I have a birth cert from Ireland. I'm not sure what's going on.
I know. Listen, you can get...
There's a load of... See, there's a lot of other people out there, and they're thinking the same as me.
What are they thinking?
They're trying to think, like, just to basically just to get a bit of history, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Who am I? Where did I come from? Who am I out?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like, you're allowed to find out your paternal father now. Like, I didn't know that until last weekend.
Well, in fairness to you, I'll say one thing: you're certainly learning, and you're learning fast.
I wish I come here. I'm not learning that fast now. I'm 45 years thinking about this.
Stay in touch anyway. Listen to me. Stay in touch, Michael, all right? And it's lovely to hear a man now, as an adult and a mature individual, thinking about what his birth mother would have gone through and feeling, you know, pain on her behalf, because God knows she went through enough of it back in the day. We'll pick it up after 11. Text 0868104106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM. Conversation that matters.
Busy, busy, busy morning. The interlockers, if you came late, an interlocker is a device that is fitted to the car of somebody who has already been convicted of drink driving. They would have to blow into a kind of an alkalizer, and if they're over the limit, the car won't start. If they haven't been drinking, the car will start. Simple as that. And they're thinking of rolling that out and making it lawful. Already some European Union countries have it. Very popular in Scandinavia, not just for convicted drunk driver offenders, but also for people working for companies or in company cars. I thought at this stage of your career, you'd have realized how many very stupid people there are out there, says Peter. You would think. But what comes across my desk, I always find newly bewildering. Does this apply to cyclists? No. How many cyclists have been tested? And walkers on the road under the influence? How many have been tested? Drivers under the influence killing people versus cyclists under the influence and killing people. I would think that statistically, I know where the bigger number would be, wouldn't you? Drivers behind mechanical vehicles. Mechanically propelled vehicles. I'm not saying for a moment that cyclists don't cause accidents. They do. And a drunk cyclist is potentially capable of, you know, veering out into the middle of a road, langers on a bike, and a big crash ensuing. Regarding drink driving issues, I think the government should make a device available that any driver can have and check themselves the morning after drinking to be sure that they're safe to drive. No one wants to break the law, but people can be unsure if they're clear to drive the next morning or even after one glass of wine with a meal. That's fabulous. You could talk about that now for a good hour, couldn't you? Just the morning after. In the UK, 20% of those that have been bagged were bagged the morning after. I would endeavour to try and find an Irish statistic for it. But there is research that I was reading also this morning that said that way too often people who get behind the wheel in the morning know that there's a very good chance that they're still over the limit. I mean, what is the rule of thumb on that? Like, if you had a glass of wine with a meal at 8 o'clock at night or 9 o'clock at night or even 10 o'clock at night, you're not going to be over the limit the morning after if you're driving at 8 or 9 or 10 the next day. I mean, if you've got an 8 or 10 hour gap for a glass of wine, and maybe even two glasses of wine, and you've 8 or 9 or 10 hours, there's no way you're going to blow positive. But I suppose if you go out and you have, you know, 5 pints, 6 pints or something, or maybe, you know, half a dozen pints or a bottle of wine, and you go to bed at 12 o'clock or 1 or 2 in the morning, you're up again at 8 driving a car, you are still over the limit because you just haven't given it enough time. They say 1 hour per unit is what they say. 1 hour per unit. So that could be 8 hours. With an awful lot of bev, it could be 10 hours. GAA matches and music festivals. Gardaí cover is paid for by the GAA and event organisers. Did you not know that? It's been that way for 30 years. Also, what's to stop anyone blowing into the interlocker and enabling the drunk driver to drive it? That keeps coming up. People saying, yeah, but the passenger will blow into it. I know. But making an offence then for, I suppose, the passenger to do it. Listen, I was just reading out texts from people who got in touch with me about the amount of Gardaí that you would see. This is not a criticism of the Gardaí who are sent to police the likes of, say, Fitzgerald Stadium at the weekend, where there was dozens of Gardaí there. It's interesting to hear that the Garda cover there is paid for by the GAA, and in the case of a musical festival, it's paid for by the event organiser. The texter was making the point that it's taking the Gardaí away from what they really want and should be doing, you know, and that isn't managing traffic at a GAA match. I know plenty of people who would get into a car with a drunk driver. To answer your question, Neil, it's not uncommon, especially among students. Some mightn't drive themselves and they desperately need a spin, and they will do it to get the spin. They can blow balloons with a bike pump and blow the device mouthpiece into that, can't they? I mean, what? Like, you keep balloons in the car, and once a week then when you're sober, you blow up the balloons with your own breath sober. You keep the blown up balloons in the car, and then you use the balloon to blow into the interlocker when you're drunk. Give me strength.
Text or WhatsApp Neil now. 0868 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
I suppose you could also just keep a bike pump in the passenger seat and blow into the interlocker alkalizer with the bike pump with some kind of an attachment on it. There's ways around everything. I think anyone who gets caught for drink or drug driving should do the driving test again and do 15 automatic driving lessons, says Frank. I would love if you could ask about self-testing kits. Why aren't they available? It's crazy that you have to wait to get stopped by a guard to find out if you're over the limit. But they are available. You can buy alkalizers or what you call self-testing kits. I've seen them. I've seen them in Motor Factors. I've seen them in Deals. I've seen them in Mr. Price. I wonder is that they mightn't be as accurate as the official Garda ones. I mean, bizarrely, you could fail a breath test on the side of the road and then go back to the barracks where they have the big alkalizer machine and pass that. So there would be kind of anomalies. So maybe that's what you're saying, that maybe you can buy one for €3 or a fiver or whatever. Maybe it's not as accurate as it should be, but they are there. How effective they are, I don't know. There's only two things that cause all of these crashes: slow drivers and mobile phones. End of story. That's interesting. Not fast drivers, no. Not drink drivers, but slow drivers and mobile phones. I can't agree with a ban instantly. I absolutely despise drink driving, drug driving. I was at the receiving end of someone drug driving on the phone while driving, etc. In the sense you were on the receiving end, were you crashed into, I wonder? But it would be too harsh if some circumstances to ban instantly. Take the straight road, for example, when it drops to 60 kilometres from 80 and you're doing 67. Let's say then that's an instant ban, which would be unfair. And for argument's sake, maybe you were getting a loved one to the Mercy Hospital. You would tend to drive a bit faster, but you could still be careful. And again, for the sake of argument, that your Bluetooth didn't work and you're waiting on a call from a loved one and you have to answer the phone. I'm not saying I agree with speeding or being on the phone, but an instant ban would definitely be unfair in some cases. Make people perhaps go through a retest process that is separate to the initial test and then maybe a ban after that. I think actually mobile phone use in a car is one of the greatest scourges of 2024 and of the decade that we're living in. It's just getting worse and worse, gradually worse and worse. We automatically grab the phone. We go stop at a red light, grab the phone. You know, it's something we need to try and switch off in our brains. If you have a driving ban for drink driving and are caught again, it should be a life ban, full stop. You got your chance once, caught again, life ban. Just two more on this. How about charging the sober person for blowing into the bag with the aiding and abetting of a drunk driver? Yeah. Is it possible to do an actual test on who blew into the bag, some kind of DNA? We're getting quite technical now, lads. Interlock sounds great, but it's not going to stop drug driving, which is even worse. Cynthia Varaku said they're working on the tech where the interlocker or the inbuilt alkalizer would do both. It doesn't right now, but it would pick up cannabis or it would pick up cocaine. I don't know if it would pick up amphetamines. That would be a blood issue, I suppose. It turns people into thinking they're invincible on the road, drug driving. That's what cocaine does. It gives you more confidence, and the result is you will take more risks in everything, including driving. It's a disgusting drug, cocaine. I can't for the life of me understand why Ireland is the highest user in Europe. That's pretty sad. Love the show, says John. Yeah, I mean, it comes as a devastating statistic, but we are, per head of capital, the biggest user of cocaine in the European Union. That ain't nothing to be proud of. Keep them coming. Can I also say, I'll get to phone calls, I'll talk to Des in a moment, but that's some good news for those of you that love your music, because I've now taken delivery of my stash of Live at the Marquee tickets from Aiken Promotions, and I'm very thankful to them again this year. And they've provided me with tickets for the Sugar Babes, the Coronas, Gavin James, Van Morrison, Bingo Loco, Bicep, John Bishop, One Day, Damien Dempsey, Neo, Brian Adams, Jenny Green, Christy Moore, Mick Flannery, Biggest Disco 90, Lyra and Tom O'Dell. I have tickets for all of those gigs to give away, either on this show or on my Instagram page. So if you're not following me on Instagram and you like those gigs, might be an idea to give me a follow, because in the coming weeks, definitely across the month of May and June, we'll be giving those tickets away on air and on Instagram for the best call of the day, best text of the day, best email. So contribute to the program, get on air, particularly if you're a fan of the gigs at Live in the Marquee, and you could be lucky enough to snaffle a couple of tickets. Okay, so that's all to come. Bear that in mind. Back to the phone lines we go. Des, good morning. Thank you for holding. Morning, Des.
Neil, how's it going? You well?
Good, thank you. Just picking up on a caller just before 11 o'clock this morning, John, who was born, not unlike you actually, early 1970s.
Yeah.
He still is living with, you know, the anguish of what his mother as a young girl would have been put through giving birth to him and giving him up for adoption in London. You wanted to pick up on that?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was adopted. Well, no, thankfully, I was never one of those modern baby homes, you know?
Yeah.
But I was born in Dublin. I was born in Dublin. I lived there most of my life. You probably tell by the accent.
Oh, yeah.
But they won't hold it against you, will you?
I won't hold it against you. I know some lovely Dubliners.
Yeah, I'm not that bad, you know.
Are you down in Cork now?
Yeah, I moved out to Cork last September.
Okay, good man. Well, welcome. I hope you're settling in. Fair play to you.
Oh, yeah, lovely. That's grand, yeah.
Okay. Anyway,
I basically got the birth information from TUSA last year. And then all my adoption files. And I saw the mother's name, father's name. And, you know, they were living in Cork. And I also thought they were Dublin person because I was born in Dublin, you know.
Mm-hmm. And were they, so did your mum, your birth mum, if you like, go to Dublin to give birth, was it?
She did, yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
All right, okay. And was it a case that, was it because that's what she was told to do as a young girl, is it?
Yeah, kind of single mother and she couldn't, obviously she couldn't have me, you know, she couldn't be a single mother back then, you know what I mean?
That's right, that's
1973,
right.
You know, yeah. Just the way she couldn't have.
Yeah.
She could have gone back to mother with me as a single mother, you know, live with the mother, her own mother, you know what I mean? Yeah, just the way things were back then, you know?
Okay.
And anyway, I was born in Dublin, and then I got the adoption files from TUSA there last year, and I was checking out, you know, my birth father's name, birth mother's name was on. I was doing a bit of Googling, you know, and I found out my birth father passed away. And I got some RIP. I used the same person by his name, his address, his occupation, the whole lot, you know?
And did you find his death then in 2020 on RIP.ie?
2023, yeah.
2023.
I got the information in 2023, right. But I found out that he died in 2020.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
From RIP.
Yeah. Okay,
yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah.
And so we had an address there. Now, I saw some from my birth mother's home address as well. Okay, we called to that house and called a few houses. Just myself, we're just chancing around, you know what I mean?
Okay, did you go with someone, was it?
My wife, yeah.
Okay, Stephen, your wife got the two addresses for what would have been your mum and your birth dad. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, we lived at the time, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And now the birth dad, he was in with some relations, but we kind of had an idea. He lived with relations in one part of Cork, and then he's born in another part of Cork, you know what I mean?
Okay. I don't need too much of the personal details of the people that he was with.
Yeah, fine. Yeah, just be vague enough, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so first of all, we went down along the area where my birth dad is from, and people saying, oh, so we'd say just for a sick man, his name is Donald Trump.
Okay,
so,
yeah.
Which is very anonymous. But there's some of that family living up another road at the back, and someone goes, yeah, I think the house there was a house sold a couple of years ago. An old woman passed away. There's a load of kids coming up with folks. Because that kind of adds up, you know what I mean? Because my birth father, there's a big, he's funny, he had a lot of brothers and sisters, a lot of aunts and uncles, you know what I mean?
Okay.
And I saw something from the death, and I saw predeceased by his parents and his brother, and missed by his brothers and sisters and his son, you know, what their names were, you know.
Mm.
So that may be how. So I'm going to find on Google who's who that house is on. Try to find out the auctioneer. If they have any name, a number or something, you know what I mean?
Mm.
So we tried, but it was actually the wrong house, quite a long story short. So we went back down to the mother's house, and her brother owns the house, but he is rented out, you know what I mean?
Mm.
I said, listen, can you give the auctioneer my name? Ask him, give me a call, please. I wouldn't say who it was. He goes, okay, fine. So we went back to Dublin then, and I was just checking RIP, and they've linked the Facebook page, RIP. So I went on to link the Facebook page, and just my Facebook, I know some of my birth father, just see these things, rest in peace, blah, blah, and there's something about rest in peace, uncle, whatever. So I've got a bit through here.
Mm.
So I sent one of my cousins just a message on Facebook, hi, my name is Des, could you please give me a call, regards to your late uncle, whatever his name was. Here's my number. The next day she phones me, goes, hello, Des, this is so-and-so.
Mm.
Ring about my uncle. I said, okay, you're his niece, yeah. And she goes, I said, so is your mother and father, like his sister? Basically, her mother was his sister.
That's
you know?
Right. Yeah. Her uncle, yeah. Yeah, your dad.
Yeah, her uncle. And and then, so she gets the mother. She goes to give me a call. The mother phoned me. I just said, I first asked, did you remember my birth mother? She said, I remember her. gone down a good 50 years. It was a bit strange. What's he on about? I was the basis for herself and with the father's name, had a kid together, put up for adoption. And she was in shock.
So your birth father's wife did not know anything about you?
No, no. My birth father's family, brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
Nothing about me, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But anyway, she phones on all the rest of my aunties and uncles, and so this is great to hear. So I drove down to Cork, meet us in, you know, Cork for a cup of coffee. So I drove down to Cork the following weekend, met up with them. That was great. I met my half-brother as well. My father had a son as well, you know?
Yeah.
And so my half-brother. And then one of my aunties on my birth dad's side knew my birth mother's sister-in-law because she has an unusual surname. And she goes, "Are you related to so-and-so?" You know what I mean? So I said, "Oh, yeah, she's my sister-in-law." She says, "Listen, I haven't seen her in a couple of years' time now. They're doing kind of a group together, you know? But if I do see her, I'll get to give you a number."
Mm.
I said to her, "Yes." I said, "Fine." And then I came down on Saturday to meet my aunties and uncles for the first time. This was in February last year. And then the following Tuesday, my auntie at the bus stop, and we walked by and bumped into my birth mother's sister-in-law.
Right. Yeah.
Hadn't seen her 2 or 3 weeks. Obviously, it was COVID as well. But, you know, people didn't see that much each other, you know what I mean? But, and she goes, "Listen, can I give you a call later on? There's something big to tell you." She goes, "Okay." So my auntie phoned my mother's sister-in-law and goes, "Listen, did you know that so-and-so had a kid together?" And she says, we know all about the kid they had pulled up for adoption, yeah. But he's at the finals and he wants to hook up with whatever, the birth mother's name. And, okay, fine. So she calls off the birth mother's house. Now, my birth mother married again, but husband always knew about me. My husband knew about me after I was about 3 months old, before he even got married, you know what I mean?
Mm.
So he's all, and they never had any kids. I'm the only kid she ever had.
Mm.
But she was just shocked, and, you know, just out of the blue, her son could be found, her son's around, you know, you can phone the son.
At what age were you now at this stage?
50.
50, okay.
Yeah.
She knew she had a son because she gave birth to you. But,
her husband knew about me as well.
Yeah, okay.
He always knew about me. And you saw his joke, "Oh, your son dropped me in the college to have someday covering tattoos and long hair and everything else and earrings."
What would be wrong with that?
Nothing. I told her, if someone told me you didn't go to college to the house, I know you would have. Never know you.
Long hair and tattoos and covered in face metal, but, like, you know, it doesn't make you a bad person. You like
No. You know, it's just a joke, guy. You know what I mean? I'm kind of running joke, you know. But anyway, she gets her sister-in-law told her, and she goes, "You need a social worker." She goes, "I'm not using a social worker." I ring myself, and she rings me, and I was going to wait the following week, and she rang me about maybe a week before my 50th birthday.
What was that phone call like? Do you recall when you answered the phone?
Yeah, I do. It's a great phone call, you know what I mean? A great chat with her. And she even said, when she said something, I said back, she goes, "You're exactly like my father, that sense of humour." Whatever it was, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it just shows that things are in the genes.
Absolutely. But so is your medical history so important? Because everything is genealogically connected. So did you meet?
Yeah. My birth mother.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Met her loads of times. Yeah. I was in her house on Sunday there for dinner as well. You know what I mean? I see a good lot of her. We went away for 3 or 4 days last year in June as well for the June long weekend. I've seen her lots of times.
Was she over the moon to have been reunited with
her? Yeah.
Did you talk about the events of those 50 years or previous?
I just talk about her life in general, you know what I mean? And, you know, I kind of, like, she told me when she's driving out from the hospital, a cousin of her mother's living in Dublin. I gave a lift out from the hospital to the adoption centre in Dublin, and she hands me over to Nona, and she goes, "Am I supposed to cry?" And the driver goes, "Just do whatever you want," you know what I mean?
Mm.
And she always used to think, she always hated February because that's my birthday, you know, that time of year.
And did she talk as to why was she too young, or was she under pressure, or was it the social norms?
I've worked out why, you know what I mean, reading between the lines what people have told me, you know, but I'd rather just not say it on the radio, you know what I mean?
That's fine. Yeah.
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 But yeah, it is. You can boil it down to, you know, obviously the crux it would be. I mean, like this, if I was born today and everything the same, just it's Ireland since around 1973, she's keeping me. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, but that would be 2024. Through the prism of 73,
yeah,
there was a chance that she wouldn't have been allowed to keep you.
Yeah.
I'm so delighted. It must be great for both of you to 50 years later.
Because all too often,
people like your good self, you know, search, fight the good fight, and find that the person they're looking for has passed away, as was the case with your dad.
Yeah. Well, kind of, I felt myself, I had to go look for them, and even if I didn't find them, at least if I've tried everything, then I know, okay, if you tried everything you could do and it didn't work out, then I'd have no regrets, you know what I mean?
Oh, no, yeah, you'd have to do it. If you'd just niggle away at you all your life and you'd regret it at the end then, you know? Like, I have spoken, sadly, with people on the air, both men and women, who did exactly that. But when they got in touch eventually, their birth mother or father didn't want to know. And some of the reasons were, I never told anybody. I have a family and a husband now. I can't engage with you.
Especially like, you know, I have a sister, she's adopted as well, and I was telling her one day, she was, just be careful here, like, she could have been with other kids, right? You don't know what you're doing here.
You don't know, but it's a gamble that many people want to take.
For me, I knew I was taking a risk. I called back probably, said, look, I have to take this risk for myself to find out my identity, find out things, you know what I mean?
And did you move to Cork to be closer to her ultimately then?
Good man.
Family
as well,
great stuff. Fairy tale for you, man. Well done.
You can make a movie about this one.
Good stuff. Lovely story. Thanks for sharing, Des. Nice one.
No problem, Neil. All the best. Thanks for the call.
Take care and thanks for listening. Text 0868104106.
Text or WhatsApp Neil now. 0868104106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Big response to my chat with the endocrinologist, Dr. Mary Ryan, about burnout and women, saying that it's at epidemic proportions, that women feel guilty to ask or to demand more of their men, their fathers or their sons. Interesting response to that. I live with a husband for many years who said I was difficult to live with. Turns out he was gay, but he kept that fact secret. I knew something was wrong, but wasn't sure. I know that's slightly off topic, but it's still very interesting. Woman's work is never done. That's probably why women are paid less than men, says Paddy. Ha ha ha. Yeah, because the work is never done. I get it. The doctor on about gender pay gaps and how women's sports should get the same coverage as men's sports is hilarious. It's infuriating. Will you please tell the doctor that men don't just go out and abandon their families every morning and go off to relax on a beach. They are digging our roads, building your hospitals, cleaning your sewers, taking away your trash, keeping your electrical grid running, fighting your wars. Please challenge people, Neil, on stuff like this. Okay, well, I'm also to blame, see. I'm sick of listening to this. Why don't women paint the house or clean the gutters for me? Why is all the dirty work around the house left to the man mainly? There was a family of four girls and one boy. The man's attitude was that he was going to be working for the rest of his life, so he was sent to Christians. All the girls went to public school. By the way, all the girls are still working into their mid-40s. Another few. Oh my God. All women are oppressed and all men are evil, I see. It's women holding women down, Neil. In the past 5 or 6 years, how many women were leaders of countries, world leaders? So what do these women do for women themselves? The women earn less because they're missing work because of their menopause, brain fog and depression. All right, so we got a lot of comedians as well this morning, I see. Good stuff. Listening there to all the family stuff, I don't know what has gone so wrong with family life. I was brought up in a big family and my mother did everything in the house, the dinners, the washing and everything to do with us children. But one thing was for sure, we had a very happy home. We all laughed together, had no stress whatsoever. I think people's expectations are way too high today and they're wanting far too much, like with the new cars and the latest new phones. It can stress people out and it can stress people out and it can make for very unhappy homes for children. Before you know it, they're gone and taking nothing with them only a horrible childhood. That's sad to hear. I mean, I do know what you're saying, you know, stressing to have the best of everything and the newest of everything and feeling that you must. And you know what? There would be kind of, you get the endorphins maybe for a day or two with the new phone, maybe an hour or two, or the new car or the latest gadget. And after a day or two, of course, it's just you're on to the next thing. So there's that, just that, yeah, rush for a while, you know, the sense of, oh my God, this is fantastic. And then, of course, you tire of things way too quickly. Anyway, keep them coming. We'll come back to those texts again in the morning. But I did talk about interlockers this morning, and a big response to that, literally a device or a gadget that's fitted to the vehicle of somebody who's been already convicted of drunk driving. They would have to breathe into it before the car would start. And then there was points being made about the existence of this kind of technology in trucks and Arctics and stuff like that. And I just wanted to clarify that. Paul Jackman is a member of the Irish Road Haulage Association, joins me by phone. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Neil.
Thanks for taking the call at short notice. Are there these kind of mandatory features in trucks and Arctics and vans and things?
Yeah, I think it's GSR2, I think is the term they're using it. And what they're doing is they're giving more and more of the vehicle management over to technology and sensors. So tire pressure monitoring, for example, but that would be standard on modern vehicles.
A lot of cars have that.
And lane assist, emergency braking assist. All the modern trailers would have ESC, electronic stability control. So this is becoming, if you call it, intrinsic in all the modern vehicles. And it is like the modern trucks; they can have a predictive cruise control. They memorize roads. They know when to change gear. And they have the speed limit alert as well. And actually, if someone puts on their phone, you know, has a GPS in their car, they'll see that the car is telling them the speed limit of where they are. Mm-hmm. And if they're going over, that'll flash. That's all in trucks. But you know, have a modern cruise control system in a truck where it'll actually read the sign and slow the truck down itself.
But that truck is cruise control as opposed to, it doesn't take over the driving.
The autonomous driving is coming in at very light levels, but the truck is getting more and more intelligent and is gathering more and more data on the routes. And definitely for a truck that's on the same route very regularly, it will drive. It'll do a lot of the driving with the driver maintaining absolute control and obviously of the steering wheel. You know.
Yeah, yeah. There is tech in cars now, I think, where if you stray across the white line, whether it's broken or not.
Yes.
That the car or the vehicle will automatically brake and correct.
It'll kick the steering wheel back, dynamic steering, and that's lane assist. LA is the abbreviation.
But you can turn those off.
If you indicate, you can turn them off. Yeah, they'll become mandatory. Eventually, I think you won't be able to turn them off. And I have it in my car, and the first thing I do when I get in the car is I turn it off. Because I just personally I don't like it, but this is growing, and the drowsiness detector is becoming mandatory in the trucks. I think the figure is 95% of incidents on our roads are due to human error. So they're just making the trucks more, or the vehicles, which are obviously cars as well, become more independent and more aware of their environment and taking evasive action.
I see a lot of the new tech. My wife got a new car last year, and I was just blown away with the amount of in-car systems that it has. But how does driver drowsiness warnings, how do they work?
It's reading your eye movement, your blinking of your eye, and I think it's measuring the how open your eye is, in my car, which is a modern car as well, if you're driving, it actually tells you to take a break after a certain amount of time. When you're on the phone a while, it gives you a warning as well. You've been on the phone to maintain attention, you know. But if you look at the front of all the modern cars, you'll see a box which is the radar, and you'll see on the windscreen, you'll see the camera, and that's feeding all the data back to the this level of autonomy that's going on within vehicles.
Incredible.
And that's been on trucks since Euro 6 came in. The Euro 6 engines came in. This was part of that, and the EBA, the emergency brake assist, became in as part of that as well.
So, what about the alcohol interlock facilitation installation, as they call it?
Yeah, I think that's been in Sweden, but a long time. It's a standard feature in their cars where you must blow into you must give a breath test to the vehicle before it'll start.
Or else it will alco-lock the vehicle.
It'll lock the vehicle, yeah. So that's coming in. That's going to become the norm in Europe, and it'll presumably be in the HGVs first. There's a new level of GSR coming in July, as in a new vehicle that's been registered after the 1st of July. We have a lot of these, like the drowsiness feature.
I know. Tire pressure monitoring. I get that. It's just I got some texts this morning saying that it was already... most truck companies are using the system, so the vehicle can't be used unless a clear sample is given before they allow the truck to start. Is that somewhere in Europe, but not here, is it?
It's a feature you can specify in your vehicles. I haven't seen it, nor have I ever used it. And I haven't seen it, and it's not in any of my vehicles, and nor have I seen it in any vehicle. But it is an option that you can get.
Okay,
so but it's becoming mandatory. Where it'll be a mandatory feature, and you won't be able to bypass it in vehicles soon, because it's part of the new regulation that's coming in. Like the EU has a target of zero road fatalities by 2050, and this is all in that pursuit.
For all motorists, or for those driving for a living, which could be a truck driver, an Arctic, a taxi, an ambulance, anything like that. Or would it be all?
It's coming in on HGVs first,
right?
Which is always, and all the technology that you're seeing, as you say, in your wife's car, like that's been in trucks for years. So whatever's coming in on the trucks, I presume it's inevitably.
Have you blind spot systems?
It is actually their intention to put it into that the European vehicles will be the safest in the world.
Okay,
and
okay.
That's their objective. Yeah,
yeah. It gives the vehicle more power as opposed to the motorist all of the power, if you like. Are we talking about multiple cameras now for blind spots? Because sometimes the bigger vehicles, the bigger trucks and articles, they can't see pedestrians, they can't see bikes, they can't see, you know, the back of the vehicle, the side of it.
Most of the manufacturers now would have options. Again, safe assist, city spec, you can get a city spec truck that would have all the sensors as standard. All these were options that you could have fitted. That there was private companies that were fitting, upgrading, like putting in camera systems, putting in sensors that would pick up a cyclist and give a warning to the driver. All these, but they are now becoming intrinsic in the vehicle. The manufacturers are putting them in now. So the trucks are actually getting safer. And a small point, anyone that's out on the road, what you would see is you can now see a lot more of the driver in the modern vehicles than in the older vehicles, because there's much more glass, the dash, the sills on the windows, everything is down lower. The driver is higher. It's given the driver a much better view of what's around them. And then most trucks would have a sensor on the left-hand side, and in some cases a camera and a monitor on the pillar on the left-hand side, so they have fantastic views around them, which is a big improvement on, as you say, the blind spots that were there.
And so a 2024 Arctic or big truck or big HGV, a brand new out of the showroom, must be an incredible machine to sit behind the wheel of.
There's one manufacturer. I think there's 123 computers on board in the vehicle to do with this element of it, as well as controlling engine issues, gearbox, back axle, and all the brakes, etc., etc. So there's a total of 123 computers.
Oh my God! I don't know. As people listen to the radio now, saying 123 different things to go wrong or break down.
Well, the voice scripts is idle. The voice scripts has no role in it anymore, I'm afraid. And as you know, with cars, you must go back to the dealer because they've become so. Everything is integrated.
It's all plug-in now, diagnostics. Yeah, fair play. Listen, Paul, we covered a lot of ground. You know your stuff. Thanks for taking the call. Appreciate it. It's Paul Jackman, member of the Irish Road Haulage Association. He's got a lot of trucks and HGVs himself. He knows his stuff. Back after the break, text 0868104106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
Part of the conversation, text 0868104106. I think there's only the one left now, lads, and sooner or later there'll be none on the streets of Cork.
Right. robot.
There's a little bit of audio there. There's a long conversation following that in 1977 where Marnie Vurek, who talks to a robot, and another few of the Echo Boys from 77. But that was back in the day when there was Echo Boys all over the streets of the city and the suburbs. One or two of the more famous one would have been Olivia Kelleher's dad, John Kelleher. He was some man to run between the traffic up there at the Coliseum corner. We have the one left now, and of course that is Dave. The only Echo Boy left now standing is Dave Hogan of Farnery outside the GPO. But Marion Wyatt, who's written many different plays in the past, she's done tributes to the Sunbeam Girls, to the Cork Dockers, to the Shawleys, and to Katy Barry. It was only a case of time before she'd get around to the Echo Boys, and it's a smash hit, sold out at the Cat Club. Marion, good morning.
Good morning, Neil.
You've done it again. You've hit gold dust, apparently. Fair play to you.
Thank you. Well, not on my own. I have a great old, you know, group of troopers there with me who always come to the call. And on this occasion, they came very quickly because it's a wonderful group of people to be able to acknowledge. And some of them are still with us.
And how many years would the Echo Boys have been selling Echoes? I mean, how old is the Echo itself, the Evening Echo?
I think it's well over 100 years anyway, in and around 130. I stand to correction, but about 132 years ago. It was founded when the boys started selling on the streets very early after that. And of course, girls came later then.
Girls so later. At their highest point, pinnacle, when would that have been? Maybe the 50s or 60s or maybe the 70s? How many of them would have been out there?
Well, I believe there was 90 of them at one point all over the city. And of course, in the 60s and 70s, they started to go out into the suburbs and actually deliver to homes all across the north side. And they were very entrepreneurial. So they came up with ways of, like, they'd come downtown, collect their packages and their bundles, and then head up the hills and out to the lanes and the suburbs of the city and built up their own clientele. And then obviously as things improved, they were able to go in vans, in groups, and then hop out of them and deliver their stock and go back home with their earnings for the day.
But a lot of the time they kept their own very precious patch, didn't they? It could have been somewhere in the city on a bridge or a junction or something.
Well, absolutely. They had to prove themselves, and then they were able to get, they were called corners, pitches, patches, from different people that I've interviewed. They were called different things at different times, and some were handed down. They were generational. They were handed down from father to son and mother to son, et cetera, et cetera. And you couldn't go in there. And in fact, if you did cross that territory, they themselves had a law where they could take the papers of the person who was trying to infiltrate and dump them in the river. So it was, they had their own kind of rules and their own regulations. But for all of that, they were very united. So if somebody was, would say, selling on Finn's Corner, and somebody else was selling up by the gas company, and somebody maybe got in trouble in some way with somebody, they would run to the defence of that person, of that boy or that girl.
Yeah,
loved that about them. They were very, very united.
But so much so that, I mean, in fairness to the Crosbys, they were good to the Echo Boys and the girls because they had parties for them and they used to go away on trips, didn't they, and all sorts of things like that?
They did. And I have to say, nobody's had a bad word to say. I mean, it sounds kind of idealistic now for me to be saying things like that. But I mean, I interviewed quite a few people. I put the same questions to all of the, you know, former vendors. And everybody spoke very highly of the Crosbys. And they also spoke very highly of the distributors, you know, the main distributor people that they worked for. And I'm delighted to say that some of those people have managed to get a ticket or were our guests and have come to see the show.
Oh, lovely.
And are delighted the way we're treating it, you know. Myself and Val in particular, it was Val Denny's idea you mentioned about Dockers and Shawleys. And after Dockers, I was personally very tired and didn't know if I had the time in me to review another another story that could take years out of my life. And it was Val came up with the idea. And I said, well, okay, if you can get me even a nugget of a plot here, let's see what we can do.
I'm so glad you managed to put it together. Is it humorous as well? Typical Cork humour, I suppose, yeah?
It is. And you see, I think that's what's celebratory about it as well, is that we, as a people, well, mankind, we're resilient, obviously. But in Cork, we have this way of, we slap each other down, maybe, if we think we're getting too high and, you know, high and mighty. But also, when things are really tough, you know, there's the kind of like, they'll put the arm around the shoulder and say, look, we'll have a cup of tea and we'll work it out together. And I like that about them. I love that about the fact that many of them went on to work in the docks. So part of my research was already done for me in that sense. They've all worked really hard to help their mams, to help out at home. They hold nobody responsible for the poverty that they may have endured. And I'm not saying that all of them did, but those who had it really close, and I've interviewed them, and they've given me permission to use their stories in a composite way. You know, it's not an autobiographical tale, but it's informed by the lived experiences of those boys as they were then.
So who are the cast? I mean, there's a big ensemble. John Dolan said he counted 25 on stage at one stage.
We started out with 34 and 30 managed to stick it out because, as you know yourself, it takes a huge commitment, and you start out, and this is community theatre at its best, in that they have to rehearse at the weekends, that you give up Easter breaks. St. Patrick's Day was a rehearsal. And you start out going, oh, yeah, I'm all up for this. And then suddenly they realize, oh, this is work. And it is work. And it's work on top of their day's work.
Yeah.
But the frontliners, I'm very lucky in that I have people like Martina Carroll, who is, you know, a professional actor, and also Owen Halley and others. And then I'm introducing, and I get really excited about this, some of the former Echo Boys who were never on stage.
Lovely. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. They should be central to the story, shouldn't they?
Absolutely. And they sometimes it's difficult to get them to stay quiet in the rehearsal room, because every time we had to, you know, in the script, call Echo, Evening Echo, they took that like a call to arms. So from every corner of the rehearsal room, there was an echo coming. But it's lovely.
Won't it be very sad when that cry, Echo, Evening Echo, is gone for good?
Absolutely. And that's the thing, you see. I came out of a local hotel there one day after another meeting to do with something else, and I heard that lone voice of Davy Hogan's. And it brought me straight back into my childhood back in the 60s. And I thought, I missed that. And I missed the violinists who played outside the you know, outside Roach's stores. And I missed so much. And all that nostalgia in a positive way came flooding back.
Yeah.
And I just thought, because COVID got in the way of the development of it. I went off and I did Caddy Barry. And then I went, you know what? I made a promise to these people that we'd make this happen. So I said, well, we've got it.
And you did it.
Myself and Jimmy Broccoli, Jimmy composed an anthem. And that anthem is what we finish up the evening with. And I know people are finding it hard to sleep at night because it's going round and round and round in their head. That whole thing of the call, the echo call and the tune, and it's just, I'm very proud of it. It's not without its, you know, I'd be my own first critics in terms of whether things are, you know, creative or artistically brilliant or not. But it's something else for me. It's full of heart. I adore working with people who want to give things a shot. And it's intergenerational. The youngest is 11, and I hope the oldest person in the cast doesn't mind me saying they're 78, you know. This is my gift to me too, because I'm going to be 70 in July, and I'm doing this so long with nobody else's support except my own, my family, and the people who come out and support me.
Well,
so I'm hoping we can get it to a bigger venue. That's the ambition. We get it to a bigger venue because we haven't been able to contain it in the Cork Arts Theatre.
Oh, great. I'm delighted to hear that maybe April 27th won't be the finish of it. It could be just the beginning of something bigger in a bigger venue. We'll watch this space. I wish I had more time. It's lovely chatting with you, Marion. Anybody that's lucky enough to have the golden tickets, because it's sold out, will really enjoy it, because the feedback so far has been incredible. Well done. Delighted. And if I'm not talking to you before the summer, happy birthday.
Thank you.
All the best for now, Marion Wyatt. We'll pick it up tomorrow. I'd love to chat with people who were Echo Boys or Echo Girls back in the day. Get in touch. Text 0868104106 because there were some very famous ones. I wish I had more time. We'll pick up on the conversation, particularly if you were selling Echoes back in the day. What was life like? Text 0868104106. Email Neil at redfm.ie. I'll see you tomorrow.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.